The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
You're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's Owen and Tommy Rooney with you in studio for the next little while. The weekend where the Empires have not fallen but looked a little bit more fragile. Liverpool, of course, up against the hard-hitting edge of Troy Deeney. Dublin up against the hard-hitting edge of everybody who exists in OMA. And I don't know, do we feel more like equals now, seeing teams like that get beaten?
I don't know. Ultimately, to quote you, does it really matter? It was such a horrible night in OMA. Such an horrific night.
Start with OMA, yeah.
Such an horrific night in OMA. It's hard to know what to make of it, truthfully.
Mm-hmm.
Because did you see the clip of Dean Rock going for that point in the first half? And he struck it so sweetly, it's going over the black spot.
And then it doesn't even go wide.
It ends up towards the corner flag. Like, it was outrageous that the games actually went ahead, especially up north.
The Tyrone public, I would imagine, were doing a little bit of a rain dance, a wind dance, all of that sort of stuff to get this game played on Saturday night. It suits them. They've got two big wins now against two big teams at home. The talking point, though, is what happened at halftime here in Healy Park. The Battle of OBA 2 is what it's being dubbed as immediately. And this is not your ordinary halftime brawl. This is proper boxes being thrown. This is street fighting, not handbags, as often is the phrase thrown around here.
The footage that RT actually shows on the Sunday game, you can pick out a couple of players who are properly throwing punches and flaking. You can actually see their faces and their expressions as they're doing it. I think we're going to see footage here overhead from the RF Twitter account.
Oh yeah.
It's hard to make out who's doing what there. It really is. It's just hard to see who's doing what. There's a Dublin player with blue gloves. There's a couple of Tyrone lads, just hard to make out their faces. But apart from that, there's a lot of people in the tunnel. How on earth is there that many people in the tunnel?
It's because it's such a crap night and everybody wants to get in out of the field as quickly as possible.
Is it all 60 members of each backroom team packed in there? Do we know what sparked it?
We don't. Like, I presume it's just tensions running high. I'd say that there's probably a situation where there's verbals running throughout a half, and you want to be winding up your opponent, I'd imagine, if you're a team in those sort of conditions, and then it sort of just comes to a head once you get to halftime and you actually meet them in close quarters.
I'll tell you one thing, Meath football has right. The dress rooms in Park Tolton are split.
They're split, okay.
So
right,
if you're going opposite ends, halftime or whatever it is, if you're going off the field at halftime, you're going in one way and they're going in the other.
That's good health and safety there from everybody in Meath. It's looking at Mickey Hart's comments, he says, Tyrone have already served their punishment. Because Padraig Hamsey, of course, got black carded. He was the only person to get punished afterwards. Which is, imagine being Padraig Hamsey in that situation where you're like, I've just witnessed a bar brawl. I perhaps was doing something, perhaps doing nothing. And suddenly I'm the person who's picked out for a black card.
Yeah.
Like, was it even for that? Was there something else perhaps before half time? I don't know. But
I happen to be, I've never been in a brawl like that. I've never been in a situation like that in a football pitch, but I happened to recently enough, it was completely harmless, but in a game in the last few months that I've played in, do you know, usually when a fight breaks out in the field, everyone will jump in and try and pull them apart. I used to have an awful habit of getting involved in those pulling apart of rows, and you know,
and what does that involve? Does that actually
just getting your teammates, making sure your teammates aren't getting
flaring things
in the
up further
track? Yeah, or else maybe I might be the person who initially sparked it, where I might have got hit and whatever, do you know? I've been involved in those sort of rows. I've never raised my fist, as Pat Spillane said last night in the football field. But recently enough, a row broke out. It was in January. Nothing in it. And I was like, it's cold, it's January. I'm not running 60 yards to get involved in this. But I happened to be standing near the referee. He picked out one player out of about 20. Just picked out one player. Like, that was it. Like, so, and that particular player didn't really do anything. Like, but the referee didn't just take a notion. I have no idea what Padraig Hamsey did in that row. I wouldn't say he's the only one that raised the fist or did anything, because you can see a number of fists going there.
It's actually impossible to tell whether or not he is one of the people who raised the fist. And if he is, he's certainly not the only one to do it, because there was a number of people. The one really kind of disturbing element of that footage is actually the fact that there's somebody on the ground at one stage. Like, imagine being on the ground, and if people are in such a violent mood to throw a punch, they're probably going to be in a violent enough mood to throw a kick at somebody on the ground.
We don't know, we have no idea what happened there.
Like, it's a hugely dangerous situation, so it's not great. There will be, I think, further punishment dished out.
We're waiting on the referees, of course. Cormac Riley was the referee.
Yeah.
So it's up to whatever Cormac. So everybody watching Keeney will watch Cormac Riley.
They might say that he acted and he decided to black card somebody, so therefore justice has already been served.
So like this is like in Premier League, if you give it a yellow card, it can't be rescinded.
Can't be rescinded.
And given a red card.
I think that notion is plainly ridiculous.
We'll see. Listen, if a couple of Tyrone boys get suspended and a couple of Dublin lads get suspended, it's hard to know what's going to happen from this lot.
Yeah, absolutely. It should be interesting though if they come up against one another in the championship.
There was a lot of suspensions from the Battle of Omagh, and then do you remember the tea throwing, the cup throwing incident with Meath in Dublin a few years after that as well?
What happened there? Cup was thrown.
I think a cup was thrown at Kieran Whelan and somebody roared from the crowd, "That's the only cup you'll ever lift." how wrong they were. But there was a couple of suspensions from that as well. There was definitely in the mid 2000s a lot of suspensions from whenever these brawls broke out. But it hasn't happened like that in a while.
No, like
there was no brawls in Castlebar.
No brawls in Castlebar.
Okay.
I just had to think about that for a moment, just in case I did miss anything. No, there was no brawls. I'm happy to report. Nice, clean football played out on the West Coast this weekend. Absolutely fantastic to see. We leave it up to the Tyrone and Dublin people to bring the bar down in the National League over the weekend. Just to bring you up to speed on what's happening in sports news this morning. Manchester City, English League Cup champions for the third consecutive year, beat Villa 2-1 at Wembley yesterday. In the Premier League then, Wolves up to sixth, came from behind twice to beat Spurs 3-2 at New White Hart Lane yesterday. United remain in fifth. They drew 1-1 at Everton at Goodison Park. You were watching that, Tommy. Like, Bruno Fernandes is looking the real deal.
Yeah, he just tries to make things happen. It's like when you've been watching United pass sideways for a couple of years, somebody's actually trying things. Like, he played a ball around the corner to Martial yesterday, and it happened to be too far ahead, and United got a corner out of it. But usually that ball would have gone back to David De Gea.
Mm.
Like, he just turned on the halfway line and played it around the corner, passed to Sidibe, was right back at that stage. Did you see the goal at the end?
Yeah.
That disallowed, the Dominic Calvert-Lewin goal. Mm. That had to be disallowed. Like, Sigurdsson is in the way for us. Stephen Doyle, I think, it was on commentary for off the ball, saying it shouldn't have been disallowed. But,
well, by the book, it probably shouldn't have been disallowed.
Really?
Like,
he's interfering with play, though.
I guess he is having a material impact just by standing there, but the way the rule book actually writes it, it's like, what is he actually doing in terms of interacting with an opponent, for an example? Actually being in the line of the effort is what you would say is the...
Look, I'm all for the rule book to be interpreted and not applied by the letter of the law, so I think that worked out that way. Performance of the weekend as well, though. Ismail Sarr for Watford, as you mentioned.
Yeah, he's savage.
Earlier. Wow.
He's an unbelievable player, yeah. To be fair, it's the Troy Deeney show is what I would always give it down to, but Sarr is, like, he's just ripe for picking in terms of a top four, top six club who want to go into the transfer market this weekend, or this summer, I should say. That's definitely going to happen, I'd imagine. A bigger move for him. In the FA Cup tonight, Portsmouth entertaining Arsenal in the fifth round. 7:45 is kickoff at Fratton Park. Mentioned the Gaelic Games. Mayo facing a relegation battle in real trouble now, as they aim to stay in Division 1 of the Allianz National Football League. Beaten by a point by Kerry in Castlebar yesterday. They were down by 9 points at one stage, so they came right back into it, but it wasn't a good enough second half performance to actually get them any points. Donegal enjoyed a 2-12 to 8 points win over Monaghan. That was in Ballyshannon. And then Galway remain unbeaten. They saw off Meath 114 to 112. That result, Tommy, means Meath are relegated.
Are consigned to Division 2 football next year.
A lot of slim defeats over the last few weeks. I know that's the most patronising thing you can say to any team that's ever been relegated, but it's the truth.
Not just the last few weeks. Since the Super 8 last year, we could say Meath have faced Division 1 teams more times in the last 6 months than they have done in the previous 10 years before that. So, you know, they've quite a young profile in that team. Like, eventually they need to get a win. Like, whether it's in the Super 8 this year or the Leinster Championship or what it is, they need to get a win against a good team pretty soon to be able to develop from this. And look at Roscommon. Roscommon look like they're set to bounce back from Division 2 back to Division 1. It's okay for these teams to be going up and down. There's only three or four teams that are property contenders, and then there's the middle eight after that. You want to be in the top eight, the top four of those middle eight. Like,
where would they be in relation to the pure talent at their disposal in comparison to, say, Galway?
If Meath had everyone fit, so if they had like some Mickey Newman back, Paul Carnan was back, if they had their frontline players back, and they didn't have to rely so much on the under-20 players that they had done over the last little while. Galway look really slick, but I'll be honest though, I had a feeling Meath would beat Galway, and I know they didn't, but I had a feeling Meath would beat Galway in Navan this weekend. I just had a feeling they would. I've seen them run teams very close in Navan recently. And by all means, Meath are the better team at the weekend. Galway kick 7 frees, Meath kick 1/10 from play out of 1/12. They're still very naive in ways, and they don't have Shane Walsh. Like, you just don't have a player like Shane Walsh. They don't even have a player like the man in which Johnny Heaney is playing football at the minute. Like, they're still a bit off.
Yeah, the Shane Walsh bandwagon rolling pretty heavily after yesterday.
Me do have a Shane Walsh, but he's a different kind of player.
They literally have Shane Walsh.
But they don't have...
He could potentially be the next... What age is he?
Is he 19, 20? He's a very exciting young footballer, but me kind of need a couple more lads like that to put their hands up and assert themselves.
In the hurling then, Division 1, Group B, Clare beat Dublin 27 points to 115 in Cusick Park yesterday. It was Brennan versus Cody also. It was, of course, Eddie Brennan's leash. They were beaten 322 to 119 by Kilkenny. Wexford saw off Carlow on a scoreline of 229 to 111. If you miss the scores in Group A, Limerick beat Wexford 124 to 18 points. Galway won against Cork 218 to 116. Big win for Galway there. And Tip enjoyed a 24 points, 216 win over neighbours Waterford in Thurles. And then finally, a final round of 70 in Florida saw Shane Lowry finish the Honda Classic in a tie for 21st last night on one over par. He finished 7 shots adrift of South Korean Sung Jae-im, who won his first ever PGA Tour event on 6 under par.
Sung Jae-im, tipped by John Duggan.
Oh, he was tipped in Virtual Insanity last week.
4 weeks ago.
Okay, right. Well, that's not good enough really, John. It's Virtual Insanity, 9 o'clock every Thursday. Win some money if you perhaps bet on the golf for 4 weeks later. Here's what's coming up this morning on OTBAM. The sports page is coming your way in just a moment. Alan Quinlan will be with us in studio. We'll be chatting about the news that the Six Nations is set to go behind a paywall from 2022. Top 5 stories coming your way at 8:05. And then Anthony Moyles will be with us at 8:20 to chat through Congress as well at the weekend, as well as the Division 1 National League games. Sports news with Tom Malone at 8:40, followed by a piece with Peter O'Mahony that we've got coming your way, and then AM football featuring James Pearce and Nathan Murphy, if we're lucky to get him between 9:30 and 9:30. Before that, it is time for the sports headlines. OTB AM. The headlines on offtheball.com, which we will start, is Coleman suffers injury and Doherty's potential role. It's Mark Lawrenson who was in conversation with Stephen Doyle yesterday. You can watch the full piece back on our YouTube channel or just head on to offtheball.com to read that piece. Guardiola, meanwhile, is hailing incredible League Cup success.
You got to take what you get, right?
Well, in fairness, it is the League Cup. Like, I mean... It's not equivalent to say him celebrating a community shield or something like this. I just think that this is a combination of us being desensitized to Manchester City winning everything, and
this
perhaps
was saying they won the treble in 2001 with the UEFA Cup and the League Cup.
But like, I think that that's a treble, not the treble. Mm. The treble is obviously Manchester United in 99. A treble is what Liverpool did in 2001.
Okay, technically that's probably true. The Coleman injury, we don't know yet. He was speaking off the ball afterwards as well. We don't know yet how bad it is.
Okay.
But we might find out today. But, by God, Matt Doherty's form.
Well, it's not bad. He's actually banging in another goal there yesterday when we actually need
him. And he set up the equaliser, the 2-2 equaliser as well.
It's the one position where Ireland can obviously afford to get their starter injured. Of course, we'd never want that to happen. And I don't think, like, there's obviously been plenty of debate on this programme about whether or not Seamus Coleman should actually be hanging on to the starting jersey. I think you absolutely have to start him when he's fit. But if there is one player who is ready to step in and make a big impact on the starting team, it is obviously Matt Doherty, because he could potentially, on form, be Ireland's best player at the moment.
I see there's another piece up, right, just gone up right now, Jose Mourinho's quotes on Troy Parrott.
Yeah, I've seen those. They're still saying he's not ready. We're trying to help him on the pitch, trying to help him off the pitch as well, which is an interesting one. It's not just about the development of a youngster here. It seems that they're trying to look after him. Obviously, like a report from The Athletic last week about... alleging that Parrott lacks professionalism in certain areas. Like, we don't know what the sources were or what the motives were for that story, but Mourinho kind of touching on that fact that they're trying to look after him off the pitch as well. So interesting to see if he gets a few more minutes. Obviously came off the bench yesterday, couldn't really make an impact, not being given enough time whatsoever.
He needs football.
100%. The Irish Times this morning goes with Tyrone and Dublin to escape further discipline. So 5 players across 3 Division 1 hurling games are red carded as well, writes Ian O'Riordan. So I think O'Riordan kind of mentions the fact here that there was a black card handed out, and that may actually save a few of these Dublin players. Postponed Italy tie could cost the Irish game over €5 million. So Philip Brown is leading a delegation in Paris today, knowing failure to reschedule the postponed Italy game could cost Irish rugby over €5 million. That's the estimation at the moment. It may increase if the Pro 14 and European Champions Cup experiences issues. So worrying times if you're from the RFU there, because they obviously count in the Six Nations quite a bit for a big money spinner. Sean Moran then at Congress. Back pass rule will come into force this summer. We'll come back to that in our top 5 stories, I think, and chat about that back pass rule. But there's some good stuff from Sean Moran and Malachy Kirk on the back of the Irish Times sports section there today about how much debate or how little debate there was put towards this back pass rule, which is in for the championship. This is not one of these rules that is just being floated in the league
will
be trials away from the headlines. This will be in the championship, deciding the main honour in Gaelic football from next May. And I think 2 minutes of debate was put forward at Congress.
And it's going to change so much. We're going to come back to it after eight, but that is going to change a lot.
Yeah, it really will.
I've got the mirror here. Pep, a true great. That's great, as in eight. Pep's eighth domestic trophy out of the last nine for City. Seamus adds to Big Mick's Euro worries. Carlo Ancelotti also saw red at the end yesterday after he protested the disallowed VAR goal. Sigurdsson being in the way for that goal. Klopp demands a cop reboot and waiting game is tough. Peter O'Mahony admits that playing the waiting game is frustrating for Ireland's players as they're waiting to find out what's going to happen next. We have a piece coming up with Peter O'Mahony later today.
The Irish Daily Star this morning goes with freezing hell. Players treated by medics for hypothermia. Mark McCadden this morning writing that Galway United boss Alan Murphy has revealed that nine of his players were treated by medical staff for hypothermia after Saturday's first division clash against Shamrock Rovers 2 at Tallaght Stadium. Some of his players vomited in the dressing room and on the bus home.
Oh my God.
The match went ahead in bitterly cold conditions as Storm Jorge hit the country, and the effects were soon apparent as the game was completed in freezing weather. So one of the players was taken to hospital after the match because he displayed signs of frostbite in the wake of the 1-1 draw. The team doctor for the Hoops, Alan Byrne, spoke with a number of Rovers players yesterday morning to check in on their health. He's quoted here saying, "We had to take Killian Browder off at half time. I had to rip his jersey off and literally bear hug him to get some warmth back into him." That's incredible stuff.
That is insane.
I don't know for a fact this happens, not on this level maybe, but it has happened in GAA games before in the National League where players are forced to go out in these sort of conditions. Healy Park on Saturday night, I'm sure, would have had people in a fairly difficult position as well. But geez, that's extraordinary stuff from Galway United there.
It's a remarkable story. I have the Times UK here. Guardiola, my history, boys. Six Nations set for pay TV, as you mentioned a little earlier. Now we're going to get into that with Alan Quinlan in a few minutes. And Wilder forces Fury rematch. Deontay Wilder has officially triggered his rematch clause with Tyson Fury.
Could be a fight this July, which I guess is a very, very smart business move, where especially in the United States now, everybody's talking about Wilder and Fury. The rivalry is still a very hot thing over there. If you announce this in the next couple of weeks, suddenly it's like, right, I know when I'm getting my next helping of this, I'm going to stay in the loop of the story. And then all of a sudden, it's a good 6-7 month boxing story in the United States, in the limelight. And Anthony Joshua will have to wait in the wings until the end of this year, potentially 2021, before he actually gets a shot at Tyson Fury or Wilder. We'll see how the second rematch goes. Back page of the Irish Sun this morning is, "No one will dominate like us." Pep hails City's 8 of 9 pots, I should say, as they win 6 in a row. The 8 of 9, we should say, includes Community Shields. So it's not 8 of 9.
I was wondering.
But it is, 6 of 7 if you take out the Community Shield. So it's still fairly impressive. "Oh my God" is the headline from Gordon Manning's story that GAA disciplinary chiefs are to investigate the tunnel brawl on Saturday night. And Coleman, for anybody listening to us, it's KO at the top. Because, you know, Seamus Coleman could be KO'd of Ireland's Euro 2020 playoff with Slovakia. So limping out of the 1-1 draw after 28 minutes yesterday. Ancelotti confirmed it was a muscular injury.
Is that top of the morning so far? I think it might be. Oh my God.
Yeah, top of the morning to you. Oh my God. Well done to the Irish Sun.
Okay, the Guardian Sport. Guardiola, City in a league of their own. And then the top up here, Froome can leave UAE after coronavirus lockdown. And in the cricket, world beaters, England crush West Indies to march into T20 semi-finals.
Spring Break is the headline on the Irish Examiner this morning. Galway's league hopes Brighton as Cork shudder to a halt. Staying alive, tip make hard work of 13 Mandasia. Flannan's Delight is the headline as there's a 22nd hearty title for famed Clare College. Karaoke Kingdom, sing song tunes, carry up for Mayo win. They went singing songs and got some karaoke into the hotel on Saturday night after their game was called off. Banner boost then, Clare winning.
Were you there Saturday night?
I wasn't singing with them. We may have been singing elsewhere in the county of Mayo, but we certainly weren't singing with the Kerry team.
Did you get, what was your welcome like in Mayo this weekend?
Beautiful and pleasant and warm. And a great bunch of lads, I think, is the technical phrase I'm looking for here.
Okay.
Great experience. In fairness, McHale Park, top quality place to watch a league match because you've got a covered stand and you've got a great view everywhere. Okay. It's big and it's welcoming and warm. So thank you to Mayo is what I want to say this morning.
Okay. I've got the Irish Mail here. Coleman Woe, captain injured, but aiming for playoff return. Sheedy's men land an early blow in Battle of Munster heavyweights, that's in the hurling. And Pep claims no team will ever match City's amazing trophy haul as Villa are vanquished.
Back page of the Herald this morning is GAA probe Dubs row. CCCC likely to investigate tunnel brawl in Omagh and Coleman an injury concern for Ireland. Paul Curran writing about Tyrone's fighting mode saying Hart still has the Midas touch.
Got the Racing Post. Paul Tennant's column inside. And at the back, Christian Spirit. Pompey Powerhouse can trouble Gunners. Arsenal Portsmouth tonight. Or sorry, Portsmouth Arsenal at Fratton Park.
Finally for me then, the Irish Independent is leagues apart. System changes leave little to play for as NHL goes from brilliant to boring in 12 months. I tend to agree with Eamon Sweeney on that one. It is a phony war, really, this entire league campaign, because they go into the real league at the start of the summer.
The Telegraph, they've got the Six Nations paywall talks, Wembley Wonders on City. And then the final whistle column is on Sport will learn that fan-free events are worthless. Coronavirus is showing that crowds are vital to create the drama and the magic.
Right, good stuff, Tommy. So, Mór Trasna Chealaig caught up with Peter O'Mahony last weekend for Dove Men Plus Care. Proud supporters of Irish rugby from grassroots to grand slams, Dove Men Plus Care know the importance of caring for every position you play, celebrating a new season with a new definition of strength, one with care at its centre. Here's O'Mahony on that defeat to England last weekend.
I don't know. I was disappointed, to be honest, personally. I was disappointed from a team point of view. You know, it's not something that one of us would come out saying, "Here, I was grand. I was okay at the weekend." You know, it hurts us all when we don't perform in an Ireland jersey. You know, you feel like you let a lot of people down, and they're the ones that are tough to live with and tough to take. I don't think people realise how hard it can be. You know, there's a lot of pressure on, and you know, I suppose we're lucky. We've the big days where, you know, you win trophies and it's all great, but and that's all publicised and it's good at the time, but you know that. You'd talk to lots of players and players have been quoted saying you'd always remember the big ones you've lost more than the big ones you've won, unfortunately, and they stay with you for probably longer than the wins.
Yeah, full piece available now on youtube.com/offtheball. Peter O'Mahony in conversation with Mór Trasna there for Dove Men Plus Care. Alan Quinlan is in studio. Good morning to you, Alan.
Morning all.
Still kind of picking through that England defeat. It's just going to last that little bit longer because of this weekend not happening and the fact that they won't actually have the opportunity to go out this weekend and actually right some of the wrongs of Twickenham.
Yeah, it's difficult for the players and they're going to have to address it for a while, I think. And unfortunately, they don't get to play next weekend to kind of put it a little bit behind them. So it's, it's still irking away at them, I'm sure. And they'll probably be questioned for a little bit more on it.
Johnny Sexton was speaking at the weekend. He says, I got some great advice recently. When you're leading in an orchestra, you've got to turn your back on the audience. So he was asked about Ronan O'Gara's comments on Off the Ball actually last week, talking about the fact that he perhaps didn't think Sexton should have got the captaincy. Sexton says, that's something you've got to live by. And sometimes when things are going well, you can fall into bad habits and you can have a little peek and see what's going on in the audience. But I thought Roger's coaching at La Rochelle. I don't know why he's talking about us.
Yeah. Well, he's entitled to talk about him, isn't he? Because he's a paid analyst on Virgin Media, and he's an analyst here on Off the Ball as well. So I think, look, he's obviously talking about, you know, not letting the outside noise affect him too much. But I think it's part and parcel of what you've got to deal with. It's part and parcel of being the captain now that he's got to address these issues and deal with them. And you know, Johnny Sexton is a very, very competitive person, and I think he probably, a bit like Peter O'Mahony, the temperament they take, the defeat's very, very difficult, and they're very, very passionate about it. So I think you've got to deal with the criticism. And as a player, and they'll understand when they finish themselves, you're in a bubble that you feel the whole world is against you sometimes, and they're not. You know, Rog, I think in his comments, was really speaking about the pressure and the amount of responsibility and being a captain, and particularly added to the fact that as a number 10 anyway, you've loads of stuff to think about, and you've a lot of calls to make and a lot of control and a lot of communication with other players around. You can't just sit back and be quiet and enjoy the game and play to your use your talent and just play the game. It's part and parcel of that. So I think what he meant was that there's a lot going on for Johnny Sexton anyway, and it's maybe it's something that he'd be much more relaxed just being the player. But look, only he can tell you himself. He seems to have got the captaincy of Andy Farrell. There would have been a conversation, and he would have wanted it. But Rog is well entitled to his opinion, the same way as anyone is on the outside. It's just how you process that opinion, whether you agree with it or not. Johnny Sexton doesn't have to agree with it, but like I say, Rog is, I think he's earned the right to speak about it. And I don't think it was, I think maybe Johnny is taking it as a little bit, that it's a little bit of a prod and a dig at him. And I don't think he meant it in a way that he shouldn't be captain. I think he meant it in a way that maybe he'd actually be more relaxed in himself if he wasn't captain, that it's a lot of responsibility. I could never have been captain in dealing with that sort of pressure, because there's a lot going on when you're captain in a team. Some guys are very good at it. Paul O'Connell was probably the best I can remember. Dricko was brilliant. Mick Galway, Keith Wood, all these guys. Natural leadership, and you've a lot going on. You have to do all the media stuff as well. So it was something that was brought up at the press conference about that criticism, and Johnny's saying that you got to turn your back on the audience. Well, you can turn your back on the audience, but the audience are the ones who are paying your wages, in a sense, and they're the ones that are kind of filling the stadium and coming to support. So I understand what he's saying, because if I was a player, I'd be trying to, you do have to block it out as well, but reality is reality. The result was poor. And I think the players themselves, I said it in my piece on Saturday, they've got to address that themselves, and the players have to drive that forward and try and change. You know, he said that they had a plan got out onto the field, and that because the plan didn't work early on, that they need to adapt, and they didn't adapt and they weren't able to change it. Now, they were better in the second half, but realistically, the game was probably gone at half time.
Before we get into the weekend's Pro 14, just want to touch on the story from the rugby paper over the course of the weekend that Sky Sports are set to become favourites to land a deal worth £300 million and bring the Six Nations off terrestrial television. So this would be from 2022 until 2024 at the earliest. This has been spoken about for quite some time now, CVC and their involvement with rugby and their bids to try and get it more involved. Always has this idea of how are you going to cost it, how are you going to pay for it, and the natural answer is put the sport behind a paywall, and that's how the corporations make a bit more cash. Is this a detrimental thing for the sport? Because that seems to be the worst case scenario here, that rugby could potentially go the way of cricket. I think that's the obvious example that's drawn out there.
It's dangerous territory, there's no doubt about it. The money would be welcome to Six Nations if they're going to get that kind of revenue, obviously, and they're going to look at it and take it very seriously. The downside is the viewing numbers. You know, if you get 8 or 9 million in the UK watching on ITV or BBC for some of the big games, England, Ireland, Wales, England, England, Wales, depending on where they're on, and, you know, the numbers are through the roof, I think. Will the same happen? I don't know. And that's probably the question. There's obviously a lot of people who watch the Six Nations, and I know it obviously from doing the games here with Virgin Media, from our viewing figures. You know, when we did the Grand Slam a couple of years ago, we'd up on 1 million people watched it, and that's taken out of taking the pubs and mass gatherings, if you like, who are watching in different venues, out of it. It's people at home. You're up on 1 million people, which is a massive number in Ireland here. And will those same people watch it? No, they won't, because they won't all have Sky. And they, you know, a lot of people casually watch the Six Nations who are not avid rugby fans, but they have a massive interest in the history of the Six Nations and stuff. And so it's a bit of a catch-22 that you'll probably lose those kind of viewers from it. I suppose the passionate rugby fans will subscribe, and there's a lot of subscriptions at the moment with, you know, Pro 14 in Europe, Gallagher Premiership, all that kind of stuff. So if you're into your rugby, you're tending to have lots of different paywalls that you have to go into, and you know it's just a phenomenon that seems to happen. Now, ultimately, I've worked for a lot of TV companies, and you know, if they bid and put money on the table, they've got to pay staff, they've got to produce the show, if you like. And so I don't know where it's going to go, but it's a significant, if it's anywhere accurate, that it's potentially up in 300 million to have it, the sole rights of the Six Nations. It's a huge increase from, I think it was 90 million, a joint bid from ITV and BBC.
Yeah.
Which is a massive, massive jump, isn't it?
Oh, huge. Like, how important is that casual fan then? Because that is the decision they have to make, that you will sacrifice the people who stumble upon the rugby or watch it, and like if they're just sitting around the house sort of thing.
You know, when I do matches for Virgin, of course it's massively important for them to know that there's people viewing it.
Yeah, for the viewing figures, it's huge, but for the sport itself, how important is it?
Yeah, but for the first point there, the viewing figures are important for them. So that's hugely important, that you put on a show. It's like, you know, you're booking out a hall and putting on a show. Well, if there's nobody in watching or half, there's a load of empty seats. You don't want that. So nobody wants that. They want the viewing figures high. How are they going to get that with this scenario? I don't know. Maybe people will subscribe. What does it do for the game? Rugby is not a global phenomenon. I think we see that from the World Cup, that there's maybe 10 teams that are really at a different level than the others. World Rugby are always trying to expand the game and would love other nations to be much stronger, and that the game would be more competitive and would be massive interest right across the world. There's a constant progression in trying to grow the game. So you risk that scenario of growth and keeping an interest, and you don't want to lose fans, you want to increase fans, and that's the whole idea of the World Cup. You know, I was at some of the World Rugby meetings before in the planning to Rugby World Cup, and the whole theme is trying to get new viewers, people online, getting involved in the social media side of things and having an interest in rugby and trying to capture new fans, because I think there's so many sports there, and you want to attract attention and make it attractive. And obviously, if it's harder to go and view it, you run the risk of possibly losing those casual fans, because sometimes the casual fan will become a stronger fan when they see it, and they kind of get engrossed in it, and they may not necessarily have a rugby background. So it's
I think that speaks for a lot of Irish people,
it's risky,
in fairness.
Yeah, it's risky. There's no doubt about it. You know, our Gaelic games here will always be have a much bigger draw when you have All-Ireland hurling finals or Munster finals or Leinster finals. People, you know, feel a part of that kind of history, whereas you have a certain element of people who love their rugby, but then there's another large group of people who are not that into rugby. They may not play it, but then when they see Ireland playing, they want to support the country, and they want to, you know, they have an interest in what's going on here. I want to see it. There's history between Ireland and England. You know, the big Six Nations games attract massive, massive viewing figures here. So it's a risk.
I guess when you compare it to other sports, there's a few different case studies you could use. The natural one is football, obviously, but people will say football is way too big a sport to ever experience any waning of interest when you put it behind a paywall. So that's why the cricket example is probably the one that's used most often, because it is, like rugby, a fairly niche sport on a worldwide level, so it could suffer from going behind a paywall. But at the same time, I know Ger, if he was here, would be making this argument, because he's actually in favour of this paywall. He talks about darts and what Sky Sports has done for darts, for example. And I think by that same token, you look at the way snooker has gone in recent years. Like, it's not exactly being pushed through and getting new viewing figures or new viewers all the time, I should say, because it's on the BBC. Like, that's free-to-air sport, and it seems that the sport itself hasn't exactly progressed with the times just because it's not behind a paywall. So it's hard to know which example is the one that matches rugby the most, but it might actually be cricket. It might actually be that, but that suffered from mismanagement at the top level as well on an international level. There are other ways to promote the game, but perhaps.
The reality of this one is the money dictates it, and if you're getting 300 million as opposed to 90 million, it will happen.
Like, what could the unions do with that money, for example, if it's actually funneled in the correct way, is perhaps not a question we should be asking.
That's probably a deeper question as to what they can do. They can obviously put it into the development plans and spread it to grassroots rugby and make their actual games, you know, if the RFU had a windfall through that kind of money, they can actually spend more and put more rugby development officers in school and different programmes all over the country. The Scottish Rugby Union, who struggled for probably numbers of times, and, you know, they've only two professional teams, they can pump more money into to both Edinburgh and Glasgow and give them bigger budgets to sign players, all that kind of stuff. So of course you can use the money, and it's very, very, would be very, very welcome. But it's weighing up that scenario of money over growth, and growth is. But then you may argue that, look, the modern reality is that, and it's the same with reading papers. I think if you don't buy the paper, lots of people will read the papers online, and there's paywalls there, and then people do have issues with paying a couple of euro a week to read a paper, but you can't get it for nothing. All those journalists have to be paid, and there's massive costs in running companies. So it's part and parcel of the way sport has gone. I think the issue is for normal people is we're so used to having X amount of sport free to air that then when paywalls come in, it's a new phenomenon. But, you know, people head to the pub and they spend 100 quid in the weekend.
And you do that a lot for rugby anyway.
They could spend a 10 or 15, 20 quid or whatever in a subscription a month to get X number of games. But, look, it's just the way modern sport has gone. And I think probably the challenge here is if you could bundle the sports into one package, and you have your, if you're into your rugby, your Pro 14, your Champions Cup, and maybe now your international stuff in one package, people can live with that. But it's having to pay different subscriptions to different TV companies is probably causing the issues and confusions. And then people, they have a choice of watching the match or doing something else. And you know, if it's not kind of easily accessible and not too expensive, they'll have it. If it's a little bit too expensive and they view it that way, they'll let it go and let it slide. And so it'll be a pity in some ways if it happens regarding the Six Nations, particularly here in Ireland. We don't know what way it's going to work for... You know, is this just going to be in the UK? Is it going to be, you know, will BBC have the Welsh matches? Will Virgin or RTE or whoever in Ireland here have the Irish matches? Who knows what's where that's going to play out? Will some of it be free to air? Will it be just highlights packages? But it'll certainly be a challenging scenario for the viewers.
Let's talk about the Pro 14. This result from Friday night, Leinster-Glasgow, is actually incredible. When you think about it, there was actually legitimate talk here that Glasgow could cause Leinster a few problems on Friday. 55-19, not even a contest. It's, 15 wins in a row on the bounce in this competition for Leinster. I think Munster's record from 2011 has been eclipsed. A couple of different things we can talk about from this. I think we have to start with Ryan Baird, the academy lock, 20 years of age, comes in, scores a hat-trick. Is it as simple as this now, that this is the kid we need to start watching because he could set up this beautiful partnership with James Ryan down the line in a year or two, perhaps, when he gets to the age of 21, 22?
Yeah, I think so. Look, they were incredibly impressive, and they seemed to keep that relentlessness and that ruthless edge going amongst their players, and they deserve massive credit, Leo Cullen does, for the way they just keep that pressure going on teams, and they were hugely impressive. Glasgow had a lot of internationals on Friday night, and Leinster were a different level just from the word go. The pace they played at, the intensity, the accuracy, and the confidence they're playing with, it's massive for them. You know, a lot of these guys with all their internationals away, they have a brilliant scenario. The issues they will have and they'll continue to have is how do you accommodate everyone, and some of these players who played Friday night would attract attention from lots of different teams in the UK and France. So it's always going to be a challenge for Leinster, and but that conveyor belt keeps producing players, and Ryan Baird was fantastic the other night. And when you score a try like he did at the end, where he takes off and shows incredible acceleration and caps off a brilliant performance for him, he's obviously going to attract massive attention. But
what sort of player is he?
He's incredibly athletic, quick, as you've seen from the try, really good footballer. You're modern day second row, and you know, he's obviously going to mature and get stronger and become more physical, and that's probably, you know, where you, and you saw the kind of benchmark in England, that kind of level of prowess that you need and aggression at that higher level. You want your second rows to be kind of enforcers in a sense, but you can't have every scenario covered off with a player, but he's very athletic and really technically very good. So I think it's a very promising situation, not just for Leinster but for Ireland, to have a player. But it's something that's not a shock, because he's shown that in the under-20s how good he can be, an abrasive and talented player he is.
these under 20 teams that we've seen over the last couple of years are basically the real deal, that they're actually coming through. And I guess, like, when you see Kellen Dorris making the moves he's making at the moment, someone like Ryan Baird coming through, that it's not just an underage flash in the pan. These are top quality potential test players.
And it's that transition you want from the 20s into your senior setup. And Leinster have seamlessly transitioned a lot of these players. I think if you look at the Munster game on Saturday evening, and their win over Scarlets, there was a couple of players there which give hope for the future as well. Jack O'Sullivan was really good again in the back row. Gavin Coombs played very well, scored two tries when he came on. Craig Casey. So it's a really positive situation when you can win games and bring young players through. And all the other players, all the other provinces would be envious of the way Leinster have done it, and maybe the abruptness that they can get those players through. But like I said, for Leo Cullen, the challenge would be, how do you keep all these players happy? And that's something he'll have to deal with. And sometimes you might be making decisions over 50-50 guys, and whether they stay or go. And you know, these younger players coming through, they obviously, when they play a few games, and whether they have agents, some of them or not, they'll want full-time contracts, and they've got to step up into the senior group. But it's a brilliant position that they're in, and it's hard to, like, this is their second string team, and they just look so strong. It's frightening, really, how good they can be. And you put someone like Scott Fardy, and I've always said this about the overseas signings, like, he's someone who kind of gels all those young players together when he plays, and such a good decision maker, and an excellent signing he has been for Leinster. And James Lowe scoring tries as well, and being
Dave Kearney,
really dominant.
Hat-trick.
Yeah.
Like, is he worth another look in a green shirt?
Yeah, well, the competitiveness and the form of Dave Kearney is something that has been breathtaking this year. I think he's been brilliant. And the relentless kind of effort you get from him is something that I love in players. And, you know, when you think of maybe that lack of energy or enthusiasm to get the ball down under with Jacob Stockdale last week behind the goals, you just don't think Dave Kearney would be letting the ball bounce like that. So look, he's a very talented player, and he's someone who is certainly worth keeping a close look on, and I'm sure Andy Farrell will appreciate what he did the other night, but what he's doing all season as well.
There's been a bit of talk in recent months about Ireland perhaps just not being good enough, and having the players to contend with the top teams in the world. And yet you look at this Leinster team and what they're doing, like, undisputably a top two team in the continent. That players wise, they are contending on
the
world class level.
But the reality is, and people have to realise this, you step up to international level, it's a different level. So it is, you can be very dominant at Pro 14 and even dominant in Europe. It's a step up to international level, and there's very, very, very little weakness, and the power and the physicality is different. So really, you don't want to be judging players too early on their form. It can be encouraging and very promising, but ultimately there's a lot of hope and kind of positivity around players that can come through and transition into Andy Farrell's side in the next period of time.
You mentioned Coombs and O'Sullivan, they were the two standout performers from Munster.
Yeah, Craig Casey was superb as well, and I think he gives a lot of hope for the future as well. And the bit of narkiness and kind of quality that he possesses as well is, but again, a lot of these guys played in the 20s together, so there's certainly a bit of hope there as well. And they played really well the other night, and it was a good test for him in horrendous conditions. Scarlets had a player sent off, and that probably helped the cause. But to get a bonus point win in those conditions was promising for Munster. The issue they have now in the next couple of weeks is they play Benetton back-to-back. Will those games go ahead? Mm. They're a couple of points behind Edinburgh, and Munster need to try and top the group to get that home semi-final and give themselves a much better shot of getting into the final at the end of the season. So we'll see how that one plays out.
Alan Quinlan, thanks a million for popping in this morning. Camden Roadshow is where we're off to next. Just a heads up that Off the Ball will be live from the Camden Bar for the first time next Wednesday, March the 4th, for a football team look ahead to the Cheltenham Festival. Nathan Murphy will be joined by Kenny Cunningham and Stephen Hunt for some football chat, as well as a lighter look ahead to one of the biggest weeks of the year in sport with racing royalty Johnny Murta and Katie Walsh. We'll also be joined on the night by Paddy Power himself and Ireland's tipping expert Frank Hickey. It's an exclusive off-air event, so the only way to enjoy it is to be there on the night. You can head over to offtheball.com/events for ticketing information. It is 8:15 on this Monday morning. Top five stories are next. OTB AM. You're welcome back. 8:16 on this Monday morning. You're watching OTB AM. Our top five stories this morning coming your way. We're going to be chatting Irish football in just a moment. A couple of different stories to get our teeth sunk into. Seamus Coleman and Troy Parrott. Some of the names we'll be chatting about. Liverpool's unbeaten run, meanwhile, comes to an end. 3-0 defeat at the hands of Watford on Saturday night. GAA Congress as well. A few interesting talking points from that over the course of the weekend. Mayo then, they've gone down to Kerry yesterday. Now staring relegation. Really in big trouble getting relegated at this point. We'll get into their performance yesterday. And number five, which is where we will start today, Tommy, is Sarsfield Sisters. What's this?
It's just a great story. Sarsfield's club in Galway. They've won their very first Club All-Ireland title yesterday. They beat Shlochneil. Shlochneil were going for four in a row. Obviously, Shlochneil have had absolutely amazing success across football, hurling and camogie. And there's been a lot of talk about them as a club over the last couple of years. But yesterday, for Sarsfields, and especially the McGrath family, they had Matty as the father, Siobhan, Orla. Siobhan scored a winning goal. Orla was there. Niamh was the captain. Orla was the centre forward. And there was one more sister who I've just lost her name here. But there were four sisters on the team as well. And just, I suppose, it's a story of redemption, perhaps. You know, they got to the All-Ireland final twice in 2017 and 2018, and Shlochneil bet them both times. And yesterday they finally got the win.
What were the, I'm trying to think back to the finals against Shlochneil previously. They were healthy enough wins, I think, for Shlochneil.
For the Camogie finals, yeah, they were.
So, like, I mean, this is kind of a bit of a turnaround. They've been a bit of a juggernaut that have been hard to stop, I think, Shlochneil over the last few years. So that's a class story. So, four Sarsfield sisters, and of course, their dad, as you mentioned there yesterday.
The match winning move in the 61st minute. Siobhan scored the winning goal, the youngest sister, 19-year-old. The move went from Niamh, the captain, passed it to the eldest, who is Orla, who passed it to Siobhan McGrath, who scored the winning goal.
That's class. Well, congratulations to them yesterday. We'll move back to story number four, which is Mayo over the course of the weekend, staring relegation. Down the barrel of relegation, I think it's fair to say. Sinking feeling as comeback comes up short is the headline in the back of the Irish Independent. Is this a bad thing for them?
That Mayo were going down.
Getting potentially relegated, like given the raft of new players that have been trying to try out, and I don't know, a division down there like didn't necessarily do Donegal a whole pile of harm. I guess you do want to be testing yourself against the best, especially when you are trying new kids out, but by the same token, flying under the radar for a season, it hasn't always been the worst thing in the world.
No, it hasn't. It's just that Division 2 is obviously such a snake pit, like it's so competitive down there.
That there's no guarantee of getting back up.
There's no guarantee. Like, Mead have been, to go back to Mead, they've been third for 4 years in a row, and that held them back massively. Yeah. Donegal obviously went straight back down and straight back up. Kildare were in relegation trouble if they didn't beat Leash this weekend. Like, Kildare would not be playing in the All-Ireland title. The stakes are much higher now if you're down in Division 2, and if something goes wrong. Were Mayo bad? Were they bad yesterday?
Mayo's first half performance yesterday was the worst Mayo performance I think I've ever seen.
Really?
Absolutely horrendous. It's like they didn't want to be out there. Their shot selection was appalling, as if they were trying to be illogical about what they were doing. And then they lost by a point.
Wow.
Like it's incredible, really. They were excellent in the second half. I don't know what was said at halftime. They took Tom Parsons off. Aidan O'Shea was incredible in the second half. But really, I don't know what happened to them in that first half. They were shocking. They had the wind at their back. But I guess by the same token, Kerry were also appalling in the second half for them to have the wind at their back, nine-point lead at one stage. And
they had an eight-point lead last weekend. They only won by 3 points. Yeah. Kerry seemed to have a habit of doing this.
It's an issue, yeah. It's certainly a lot of consternation around. The Mayo goal yesterday was actually incredible as well. And there was a couple of
Mayo
great
goal,
moves,
remind me. I watched the highlights last time. What was the Mayo goal?
There was a complete mess-up by Shane Ryan, the Kerry goalkeeper, where he actually managed to arrest the situation, get it under control a small bit, and then it was up to, you know, when the goalkeeper's back in goal and stuff like that, you're supposed to pop the ball over the bar, but the Mayo fellow was like, nah, screw that, went for the bottom corner and nailed it.
It's a great finish.
Fantastic finish, and you thought at that point, right, there could be a bit of a famous day here in Castlebar, because that was the narrative. It was like, right, this is a team who are plummeting down to Division 2 in the first half, abject, and then in the second half, were sensational. You're like, this is how they survive, but they just came up short at the end. We're not writing them off just yet. To do two games to save themselves.
I have a feeling they beat Galway. I think Galway are there for the taking at the moment.
That's one thing I've noticed. Mayo, like, I know we were talking about the Dublin-Tyrone rivalry at the top. This Mayo-Galway rivalry is going to get spicy, is what I presume. These Mayo supporters do not like the fact that there may be a new king in town here in terms of the Connacht Championship. That there could be a situation here where there are two Connacht teams in Division 1 next year, and Mayo will be in Division 2.
Mm.
So, I don't know, there may be the third wheel in the Connacht Championship, who knows. So still though, it is Mayo, and there could be a little bit of a turnaround. They have survived by the skin of their teeth before in Division 1, and this is the longest run in Division 1 by any county as well, so it'll be big news if they do go down. Just a couple of other things. Number 3 we'll get to actually with Anthony Moyles in just a moment, is GAA Congress. Just one thing from Malachy Clerkin's piece. So he was obviously at Congress. So, yeah. Questions, points for debate at least. And yet, the following is how Motion 6 on the Clore at Congress 2020 played out. So, Motion 6 is the backpass rule, which has been implemented. At 9:34 on Friday night, it was proposed. The only speaker in favour was the proposer. Nobody else spoke for or against it. Not a single delegate felt the urge to ask a question, make a point, or express the slightest bit of interest. At 9:36, it was passed. So there you go, everyone. 2 minutes it takes to actually pass this whole thing.
It's incredible. Malachy's next paragraph is pretty good as well.
Well, actually, yeah, this is sensational stuff. In their defence, who amongst us has the stomach to be drilling down into the whys and what fors of kick-out strategy at 9:30 on a Friday night, an hour when young folk, as in the people who actually play the games, are generally fishing for Tinder replies or texting their dealer, is not by any stretch of the imagination the best time to be elbow deep in this stuff. What do they know of kick-outs who only kick-outs know? So I don't know. Like, as a club footballer, Tommy, you will be forced to not pass the ball back to your goalkeeper if you receive the short kick out this year. How will this affect you?
So just before I get back to how it will affect club football or even football as a whole, I think the essence of Malachy's point is, and his piece, is who is standing up for football. Last week we had Babs Keating in here saying that Hurling doesn't need a black card. There was a GPA poll conducted where 89% of players said Hurling doesn't need a black card. Tommy Welch came on OTBAM on Friday morning and said, you know what, Adrian, you know what the problem is? Refs are seeing too much. We don't want the refs to see as much as they are. The problem with Hurling is that the referees are giving too many frees. We don't want that much regulation in Hurling. What happens in Congress? The Hurling black card gets rejected.
Mm.
And they slip in this kick-out rule into football. And it's like, where did it come from? Like, clubs around the country are working on kick-out strategies all the time, and next thing this has slipped in. I know it's saying it's going to be in the championship for the inter-county season, but like, it's gone into WhatsApp groups last night. Like, went into our WhatsApp group. Like, we don't know whether or not this is going to happen for the summer. Like, it's bizarre.
It's completely messed up when you think about it, that there is actually, they went through a whole campaign of testing things out in the league last year, and then this just comes from like a standing group of actually drilling down into how rules are implemented in GAA, what we need, very scientific outlook on everything. And then a club proposes a similarly seismic rule, and in 2 minutes of Congress it just passes and is in for the championship.
David Hassan and the Football Standing Rules Committee had a couple of, I think, quite good ideas as well that failed by 1%. They got 60% or 61% and they needed 62%. Yet this just steamrolled through. Now, in terms of a logical interpretation of the rule, perhaps it's not the worst thing. It's going to encourage longer kicking. I feel bad for goalkeepers. I feel bad for the likes of Rory Beggan, who's been receiving ball back and running the length of the field. But in that piece by Malachy Clerkin, he refers back to, again, the Galway Mayo game last year and how Bernard Power had more touches than anybody on the field in that game. Mm. And touches don't include kickouts. So it wasn't due to wides or scores being kicked. It was the amount of times he had the ball in the hand.
Yeah.
And who was the second most player to touch the ball that game? David Clark, the Mayo goalkeeper.
Right, okay.
So like, perhaps that was the game, but you can't just dictate a decision. It's probably more to do with Cluxton and the short kickouts and the manner in which that was done. But it's going to encourage a full press. It's going to encourage...
which is always exciting, but only really in summertime.
Well, look at Monaghan's full press yesterday. That was like one of the most exciting things we possibly could have seen. Sean Patton's against the wind and he drives it beyond. Rory Beggan tries to take a black card. It would have been probably...
But he does get the black card anyway.
It should have been probably a red card. Like. Yeah. But he... and the goal is taken. So, like, look, it's just mad that it happens that easily.
Yeah.
Nobody's standing up for football.
No, it's a point that Malachy makes there, that you do have a good campaign in favour of hurling all the time. We will get back to that with Anthony Moyles very shortly indeed. Just a couple of other quick stories to touch on. Liverpool, Saturday night, going down to Watford. Did not expect this to be the way it happened. I expected... to be honest with you, I expected Liverpool to go unbeaten. I didn't see them anybody beating them, because I thought that if something was going to happen, it would have just been something really, really strange. As in an odd goal, Liverpool to have a day at the office where they have 20 shots and there's an unbelievable goalkeeper on song. Didn't expect them to get roundly beaten and thrashed, really, 3-0.
Smashed. Everyone seems to be blaming Dejan Lovren, who I feel sorry for.
Scapegoated, I think, is the word that comes to mind.
Scapegoated. We'll hear from James Pearce a little later on about how Klopp has reacted to it and why there's been this sort of a wobble. I'm not sure if I ever believed that they were going to go to a year unbeaten. I thought maybe if they got their Champions League semi-final, they had a couple of tricky fixtures there with Brighton and a couple of others in the middle of April, that they'll take their eye off the ball a little bit on the league, because the league would be wrapped up by that stage and it wouldn't matter. Again, it doesn't actually matter that they were beaten. Like, they're going to win.
Yes, it does. It does matter.
Does it matter?
It does matter. Of course why? It does. Because the Invincibles thing is such a big thing. It's like one of when you go through any of the famous seasons in English football, the first two you go to are the Invincibles and you go to the treble winning team. Mm. Below that, then you go to Manchester City's recent exploits being absolutely outrageously good, and Jose Mourinho's first season as Chelsea manager. They're in a second row. The Invincibles, the treble, they're the top thing. So it matters hugely now, unless Liverpool go out and actually win the FA Cup or win the Champions League, and then it is an all-time great season. I just don't think people appreciate enough what Liverpool have done this year, and they will not appreciate it enough in years to come. Like, they will be like, okay, fair enough, first Premier League title.
That's big. Everyone's forgetting about that.
But in terms of the general, in the annals of Premier League greatness, because Manchester City have, like, scaled to 100 points or whatever, I think that the Invincibles thing would have added another cherry on this cake, where people would have been like, okay, right, this is greatest Premier League team ever territory right now. Whereas that's one little element that's taken away from it, but I think it's an important string.
Yeah. The thing is, you can't really go out and say, we're going to have an invincible season. So Liverpool are actually in the perfect position where they didn't really have to think about it. They pretty much had the league title wrapped up.
Mm.
So they didn't have to go out and try and be unbeaten. Is it ever going to happen again where they go this long unbeaten?
Possibly will be. I think it's tougher. You will survive as long without getting a scare from the likes of a Watford earlier in the season, for example. Like, it's a good point you raise. Like, was it easier for Arsenal to go invincible because they had to win more games later on in the season because the title wasn't wrapped up because they drew so many games? Or would it be more impressive in this case for Liverpool winning games that they actually didn't need to win?
I'd be interested to hear what take James Pearce has on a little later on. And what the reaction has been from Liverpool fans.
We've got him on at 9 o'clock this morning. Then briefly, just to wrap up then, Irish football. No Seamus Coleman potentially for Slovakia. And Troy Parrott. For anybody who's missed Jose Mourinho and what he's been saying about Troy Parrott, he got a couple of minutes at the end yesterday. Obviously, he's struggling to feature despite Heung-min Son and Harry Kane not being around. Mourinho again yesterday saying he is not ready. He is not ready. He's a good kid, a good talent. He's a kid we want to help. He's a kid who needs help. Not just on the pitch, but off it. He's a kid we're going to take care of like we have since the beginning, and he's a kid who's obviously going to have a real opportunity in the right moment when we feel it is the moment. So that is like something that's definitely sticking out to me. He needs help not just on the pitch, but off it. And like, I think we kind of raised some questions last week about the reports in the rounds about Parrott's attitude. I wonder if like a lot of those reports are actually coming from people very close to Jose Mourinho himself, that he genuinely believes that he doesn't have the attitude required, or he off the pitch he's not ready to be a professional footballer for Tottenham Hotspur. Not a professional footballer, a starting footballer for Tottenham Hotspur.
It's very true. A starting footballer. Like, Harry Kane's breakthrough came quite late in his in footballing terms. Like, he wasn't like Mason Greenwood breaking through at 18. He was 22 after doing the stints then in the Championship or in League One. But ultimately, it was his attitude that brought him that far along. The big question is, for a lot of the Irish footballers that are that age, like, Michael Obafemi is scoring goals in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Aaron Connolly has scored goals in the Premier League this year. Parrott is the most talked about, and he hasn't got that opportunity yet. Why is there I don't believe that Mourinho wants to ruin this kid's career. Why is there these stories coming out if there isn't some substance to it? It's hard to believe that there wouldn't be any smoke without fire.
Well, that's true. Yeah, what's the motive of
What is the motive? Yeah. Genuinely, like, okay, I can understand in January if he's trying to put pressure on Daniel Levy to sign another striker, but after that, give him some minutes. Perhaps the fact that he's given him 4 minutes now at the weekend might loosen him a little bit and he might give him a chance.
Mm. Yeah, well, hopefully more minutes to come from him over the next period of time, but I think he just needs to get on loan this summer. Alright, that is our top five stories this morning. We are talking GAA next. Anthony Moyles is on standby. Maura Trasny-Callig was at Castlebar yesterday, and here is what James Horan said after their defeat to Kerry.
We got a chance in 2 weeks to take on a Galway team that's obviously in form, and we'll work really hard to get ready for that.
But isn't it, let's take a positive look at this though. Okay, you're saying you're taking on a Galway team who's in form. It's obvious that your form is coming, and it might be coming at the time you need it to, which is championship. As a Kerry man would say, acute Kerry whore would always say, nothing's won in February or March.
There's no doubt about that, and we've some players coming back, but we've some new guys in that have done well. So there's a lot of things that will come together, I would say, over the next 2 weeks. So absolutely, it's early in the year. It's tough conditions out there. We're doing a lot of work on various aspects of our game. Some of them are working, some of them aren't. So we'll have a look at those. But overall, we're trying to build, and I'm happy that we are building some areas.
Tough conditions externally as well. I mean, there was a lot of noise last weekend. You wouldn't have known on the field today that there was.
Yeah, I know there was some good scores and some good play out there today. And, you know, credit to the players, they stuck at it.
Look, Mayo were playing at home and they were playing in front of their home support. And by God, they got plenty vocal help from their home support today. So I suppose, look, that's something that drives every team.
Driving, that's a very good word to use. Now, obviously, Kerry had to drive up here yesterday, or I think Friday night, wasn't it? And then the game was called off, nobody's fault. That's the weather. Mm-hmm. But what do you do with that extra day? Is it hard to kill?
It's very difficult, because I suppose even coming on Friday evening, we weren't sure if we would have a game on Saturday, and then you're wondering if it won't go on Saturday, will it go on Sunday either, you know? So it's quite difficult now. We were staying in a hotel in Westport and they looked after us very, very well. And, you know, we were lucky that they are fortunate, I suppose, that they had rooms that they were able to give us and keep for us for the second night, the Saturday night. But you're on the fly really trying to get things done with the players and get something done.
Yeah, Peter Keane there following the voice of James Horan reacting to Kerry's 1-point win over Mayo yesterday. Doing karaoke all night on Saturday night to pass the time, apparently, Anthony. Just whiling away a few hours in Westport. We might start actually with what happened elsewhere on Saturday night, which is Healy Park and Omagh. First of all, the fact that this game went ahead was kind of hilarious in itself. And then second of all, less hilarious was this brawl at halftime. What did you make of that? This was, it's like, we often throw the word brawl around too easily. I think it matches something like the 96 brawl that was in the replay in the final. This was on that level in terms of punches being thrown.
Yeah, I haven't seen great footage of it. There's been obviously the one where you can see the camera angle going in. There's a couple of videos going around of obviously a supporter this one obviously having the bird's eye view on it. The problem seems to be that there's a load of supporters that can go through that gate, right, or that tunnel. There's obviously loads of backroom team. There's the two teams. So there's lots of different stuff going on. There's lots of different bodies in there. I don't think anyone's really easily identifiable. Something was said going through, obviously, and a reaction has happened. There seems to be a kind of a line of Dublin fellas and then just this, like, horde of their own fellas coming at them. Look, I don't know. There was a lot of stuff going. There was a lot of stuff being thrown, all right. I don't know how much of it was necessarily landing. But no, it's not good to see. It's not good to see. But there is an issue with those kind of, when you're coming into the same tunnel. You know, a lot of places, you obviously have to go through that way, but there are some venues where there's actually opposite ends and you can go in a separate end. You know, you don't have to go through that main tunnel. You can be separated going through. Some teams will obviously stay in the pitch now, so they'll regather on the pitch, you know, so all the 15 will come in and then they'll all go in as a unit rather than having fellas going in and mixing as you go in. Whether you do that just to kind of calm down or gather your thoughts after the first half of a game or whatever it is, or to avoid that conflict. But yeah, it's silly stuff. You don't want to see it, but I suppose it's what Dublin would have expected, really, going up there. Like, if I was a Dublin player, you'd be saying to yourself, Tyrone, I mentioned this last week, Tyrone had to make this an absolute battle. Mm. They had to make this parochial. They had to make this like the Battle of Omagh. They were on their knees after last week, you know. Losing McShane, going out in the way they did, you know, in that game, Mickey Hart would have called for them to have a massive response. And I don't think it would have really mattered who the team was. It just happened to be Dublin. So that probably gave them an added extra bit of spice to kind of get them up there to a certain degree and really kind of get stuck into them. And they did that, you know, they did that for large swathes of the game. And ultimately they won the match. So, like, I mean, you know, I saw a fella saying last week that Mickey Hart's lost it, he's lost the panel, he's done this, and then, of course, this week he'd be a hero again. Are they somewhere in between? I think they are. I think they're still struggling. But what was really interesting to me, you know, I think we mentioned it last week about Petey Hart being dogged so much by opposition teams. Really interesting to see him being played in the full forward line. And he's really good in there. You know, he's electrically quick. He makes intelligent runs. If you see for the goal, he makes a run out. He creates space in behind. He's well able to kick his own score, actually, off left or right, too. So, you know, the McShane thing may actually end up being a good thing for them in the sense that they actually find a spot for Petey Hart, that he's not taken out of games and he's trying to get box to box and he's being just dogged by a player. He can rather stay in the full forward line and actually cause a bit of havoc.
Is it unfair on Tyrone to suggest that the weather was a huge benefit to them at the weekend? That, like, I think nobody's surprised that Dublin go up there and get beaten, come back down the road after a humbling enough evening. Because I think if you translated this to, say, a Super 8s game in the summertime, which in fairness we saw last year, or a knockout game in the semi-final or an All-Ireland final, you give Dublin a healthy advantage 10 times out of 10. Like, is it just the fact that when the conditions are bad, when they have this kind of boisterous home support, they do just have an upper hand this time of the year? Or is there a real championship thing we can look into?
No, it's a leveller. There's no doubt about it. It's a leveller. I don't think it wasn't a situation that Dublin weren't up for it. You know, I think Dublin were up for it. And certainly after half time, I think they were massively up for it. But I think, you know, I think Tyrone did a number on them, in the sense of there was a number of players on the Dublin team who this would have been their first experience of this. A number of the younger guys and even some of the kind of older guys. But they've never had this kind of intensity. Be it, yes, they may have played up there previously, but it might have been on a relatively decent day. This was a real dogfight, you know. This was a real, you know, you just have to roll up the sleeves. And to be fair, I think a lot of Dublin players did that. I watched the game. I was watching kind of runs after it. There wasn't any sense that Dublin fellas threw up the flag or, you know, weren't working hard enough. They were trying to get back. They were tackling. They were doing everything they could. They were trying to break up the pitch. But, you know, I think just ultimately they got a bit bogged down in it. Yeah, so there was a bit of a lever. I think they found it very difficult to get anything going up front. You know, Bascal started really well, but then kind of petered out of the game. They brought McMenamin on, who tried to do a few things. I think again... It's a great spot for Desi Farrell to be in, because he'll learn an awful lot from that game. You know, he'll watch video of that game, I'd say, more than a lot of games. He'll really, really concentrate on, well, who actually really dug in for me? Who really, you know, put the shoulder to the wheel? Like, McCarthy was going around and he was really getting stuck in. You know, he said, well, listen, you're not going to bully me. And they tried. Tyrone tried to bully and McCarthy stood up. A number of them did. They were probably without some of their more enforcing players, Dublin. So it was a big test for them, and it was a big test, and it's something that Desi Farrell won't mind. You know, I don't think he'd be too disappointed necessarily that they got bet, because again, it just kind of resets the wheel a little bit, and they go, okay, you know, we won't let that happen again. We can understand what happened, because as you say, in Croke Park on a nice evening, you know, who's favourites for that? They're favourites all day long. You bring them up there on a wet, horrible, dirty night on a Saturday evening, it starts to level it out a bit.
For sure. Like, I definitely think that when it comes to the dog element of the game, Dublin have been so good at that, that sometimes it is unusual when you see them actually come up second best after a game that involved so much needle, that the Dublin are actually kings of this, not Tyrone, really. I wonder if that's a little bit of a concern from it all, that actually it isn't just one of those nights. Like, I know, granted, like, you look at that Teen Rock effort that was going over the bar and then actually ended up going out for a sideline. It was horrific, horrific conditions, and you don't want to be harsh on the forward line. But basically, if you told me that if there was a brawl at halftime, I would have said Dublin are going to win this game. And I think that is often the case, but just not on Saturday.
Yeah, but I think it's suited as well. You know, like it's kind of a la like the Donegal-Monaghan game to a certain degree. So the conditions can really help a team who know how to play a certain system in those types of conditions. So if you're playing a very ultra defensive system that you're all sitting back and you're willing to break and counter attack, that can really work well for you, especially if you've got a number of players like they did, of PD Hart being an outlet, right? So they didn't, Tyrone didn't all collapse in. They had a couple of fellas up front that they were able to get outlet balls to, and they were able to move up the pitch. But on an evening like that, they can frustrate Dublin, they can get them in, like they turn Dublin over an awful lot, you know, fellas running in, getting tackles, and then there was a few hits after it and the crowd got behind them. So it all fed into the game plan, really. If you have a situation, obviously, where the ball is moving faster, it's a nice day, there's no wind, there's none of those factors in, well, then all of a sudden, you know, Dublin get a couple of scores ahead, Tyrone have to come out a bit, and then, as I say, it kind of, it dictates their game plan an awful lot. So really, Mickey Hart was probably licking his lips going, this is beautiful. You know, I know when we have the breeze, you know, we can still stay relatively tight but counter-attack a bit quicker. And when we're against the breeze, we'll just play our natural game and we'll just suck Dublin in and just try and hit them on the counter. So he would have been very happy. Like, but Farrell, as I say, Farrell won't be, you know, I don't think, there was a good few guys, as I say, who wouldn't have been used to that kind of level. And it is a different level. Like when you're in Croke Park and you've got the open spaces of Croke Park and you've got the stand and you've got, you know, in the league and you've got whatever amount of couple of thousand people or 10 or 20, 30,000 people in, and there is that kind of weird sound and you can hear people shouting and all that stuff, you know, in the league, it is massively different than going up to a tight pitch in Tyrone on a wet Saturday night and the crowd are literally 10 yards from you baying for blood. So it is a different feeling. And some of these players will never have experienced that before. But now they can. They can tick the box and Desi Farrell can sit down and say, right, you will probably not get as intimidating an atmosphere ever again. And you certainly won't get it in Croke Park. So, you know, yes, we failed. We didn't get the 2 points. But ultimately, they did stand up.
In terms of a couple of the Dublin forwards here, Cullen Baskell and Sean Bugler in particular, as you said, they would have gained an awful lot from a sort of dogfight like Saturday night was. Are these two guys definitely the two to come into this forward line this year that we'll see more substitute appearances, or could one of them perhaps even make it into the starting 15?
Yeah, like Baskell took his goal brilliantly. You know, the run before it was really good. I think Fitzsimons did absolutely brilliant. I think it was Fitzsimons who managed to flick the ball out to him, you know, looked like he was going to get overturned, and then did a brilliant pass into his path. Bugler is really good. You know, he started at 11 and he shipped a lot of close attention, shall we say, from Tyrone. You know, he's a big lad. He was on Brennan, though, and Brennan is a really, really good footballer. Like, I mean, he's well able to get forward. You saw it himself with his goal. But even before that, he drives forward. He puts you on the back foot. And we've spoken this, you know, in the past about this central column, be it in Donegal or Monaghan or Galway or Tyrone. And he is a six that likes to go. He is a six that needs protection because he gets up the field, he creates stuff, he gets on the end of things. So he would have put Bugler under a bit of pressure. You know, he would have spent a lot of time going back that way when he would rather be at 11 and trying to dictate. Will they manage to break their way in? You know, I'd say Desi Farrell, as I said, you watch the video. If you watch McMenamin for the goal, you know, he loses Brennan. He kind of has him at one stage, and then he kind of goes, oh, he's not going to get it, and he gets a bit lazy, and then the pass comes to him, and you see him then chasing. That's something that will be just highlighted in the video and just shown to Kevin McMenamin, saying, can't do this, you know, you can't do this again. And it's a real, you could see him after it, he knew he took the attention off for a second. That's the kind of stuff that Desi Farrell will absolutely demand from anyone. Like, I mean, Mannion was putting in the shift, Bugler was putting in a shift. Baskell spent a lot of time. You know, when you're playing against Tyrone in that sense, it's very, very, very frustrating because you're getting the ball, you have to shift it out. You're now on a bog of a pitch. It's very hard to get your feet under you. You know, two fellas converge on you. You can't bounce the ball. So you're relying on your actual ability to move your feet. You've only got the 4 steps. You have to take a quick solo. All the defender has to do is stay close to you and then get a hand in or just pull you back a little bit. So it's very difficult. You need the bounce to be able to get out of that press. And when you don't have it on a bog of a pitch, it's very, very tough. So it requires real quick hands and runners to be coming at pace, which you saw obviously for the first goal. But no, they'll look, they're good players. They're good players. But, you know, I think What's more interesting for Desi Farrell is that, you know, can he now, as I say, analyse that game and say, right, fellas, this is a situation where it was extremely hostile. We all know what happened at half time. We came back out, we put the shoulders to the wheel, but ultimately we lost the game. But what did we learn from it?
What's the biggest brawl you've ever been in?
Oh, inter-county or club?
Either or. I'll take anything this morning.
I was involved in a club brawl when I was only 18. Well, actually, I was 19 or 20. I was just came out of minor. And I was playing corner forward for my club at the time. And yeah, that was a tasty one.
What happened?
There was an altercation with the goalkeeper and our full forward. And unfortunately for the goalkeeper, our full forward was a Leinster champion boxing dude. And it didn't end well for the goalkeeper. He ended up going through the net and taking the net down. And then the brawl kind of ensued after that. And everyone was in. Sideline was in. I remember there was a man in with an umbrella. He had a pair of Mikasa gloves and a big umbrella. And he was just clocking back on top of the head. Now, I was 18 and I was absolutely bricking it. But what happened, to be fair, my man was about the same age. So the two of us kind of looked at each other and went, nah. We're not doing that.
Two gentlemen.
Yeah. So we kind of had our own little tete-a-tete on the sideline. No, it happened in the middle of the field. It was absolute mayhem. But that was Division 5 league in Meath. That was a nice, tasty wake-up call after coming out of minor. I think in inter-county, we had a few ding-dongs with Dublin, obviously. We had one and we had two in Parnell Park. We'd one with Eamon Barry in the O'Byrne Cup. Mm. And then we had one under Coyler. Where a few fellas got suspended. And it was one of those...
This is the one under Coyler, as you mentioned. So there's a piece here from April 21st, 2008.
Oh, yeah.
While having no complaints about the refereeing performance of Paddy Russell, Dublin manager Paul Caffrey was fuming with the unidentified Meath fan who threw a cup of hot tea at Kieran Whelan after he received his marching orders. I'm sure the spectator who threw that at Kieran Whelan is not the proudest man, or maybe he is, said Caffrey after the game. Overshadowed by an early 29-man brawl which led to the dismissal of four players, with Whelan also seeing red after 15 minutes. Dublin and Meath have massive respect for each other and long may that continue, but supporters throwing hot cups of tea at players doesn't enter into it. That's not a true reflection of the great Meath supporters. What goes on the field of play goes on. That was extra.
You had a bit of everyone in there. Brenny Murphy was in there, goalkeeper, good to see. There was Paddy Andrews wearing number four.
Back in the day, yeah.
Yeah, I was injured for that one. I think I had a groin operation for that one. But it was a real...
What did Kieran Whelan do to deserve having a hot cup of tea thrown at him?
I think it was more tepid really than hot. The temperature of the tea, is the factor.
It wasn't fresh from the flask.
No, it wasn't. No, absolutely not. No, it was... I think that was what... Parnell Park is an interesting ground because... it's like a club ground, but it's obviously, you go into a small, relatively small clubhouse, you're in this dressing room, Dublin are literally across the opposite dressing room, and you can hear nearly everything. Mm. You can hear fellas shouting, you can hear managers saying stuff, you can hear everything. And I remember, I don't know if that was early on, but we were well wound up for it. Coyler was well wound up for it. Obviously 2007 had gone pretty well for us. We got to the All-Ireland semi-final. So 2008, we were trying to set some markers down. But, the one I'll always remember, there was a good few suspensions. We got hit with a good few, actually, after that, as did Dublin. I think Darren Fay may have got sent off, or Niall McCaig definitely got sent off, and he got suspended for 2 or 3 months for that, which basically was your season over. So they really came down pretty hard on it after that, if I remember correctly. Again, it was a lot of pulling and dragging and everything else. You don't want to see it, but sometimes it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. We might actually kind of mix things up here a little bit and get back to the Division 1 games in just a moment. I just want to make time for Congress here.
Lovely.
have you been to annual Congress?
Oh, yes, I have, yeah.
What's it like?
It is, I don't want to say and sound like, I'm being completely dismissive of it. What is it like? It's long. Mm-hmm. It is extremely long.
Well, it was pretty brief around certain arguments.
Well, around certain arguments it is. I tell you, it's an interesting thing. It's because there's obviously, I wasn't aware of this, but there's a certain kind of format to Congress. So let's say you know, we need to get something through. There's a certain time and there's a certain place on the list that that needs to go.
Okay.
So you either do it very early when you know you have the support and it just gets bam, 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 you know, seconded, bump, you get, and you get it through real quick, or you stick it in nice and late when there's no one around. So most of the guys, yeah, that was myself and Micheál Briody. We were in the CPA. The CPA, we went there obviously a couple of years ago during the whole transparency motion. We tried to get this motion through where basically you would see who voted, you know. Like your delegate is obviously sent to vote a certain way. You would obviously consult it in your, in, at the county meeting. You'd say, okay, which way are we going to vote? We're going to mandate. You're mandated to vote this way. Fine, you go down. But actually, you could just change your mind, you know, as you walk through the door or as someone talks to you. And on a whim. Now, listen, people are allowed to change their mind. That's no problem. But there should be a record of, well, did you change your mind? And if you did change your mind, would you mind coming back to your county who have just mandated you to vote a certain way and explain yourself if you don't mind? So that, of course, is not there. So you don't know who votes what way. It's absolutely ridiculous. I think it's probably one of the only kind of democratic situations, voting system, where there isn't any transparency. It's absolutely ludicrous. So stuff goes on. As you can imagine, there's a little bit of, you know, leaning on, shall we say. Mm-hmm. There's a fair amount of you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back going on. And as I say, there's a certain format. There's a certain kind of way. There's nearly like a dance that happens in the sense of, where do we put this on the floor? If we put it in at the end, everyone will be out of there. They'll be in having pints, or they'll be gone home, or they'll be across the road in the Crow Park Hotel eating their dinner or whatever it is. Like, so it's there's a lot of kind of, it's an old boys club, to be fair, with a sprinkling of female representatives in there and a couple of younger people. But pretty much everyone knows everyone, and all the way decided, there's decisions made prior to it, so everyone knows which way the votes are going to go.
I find it extraordinary that a fairly significant rule is going to come into play this summer on the back of Friday's Congress, that Motion 6, I think it was, that the back pass will now become a rule and it will be forbidden if you're the goalkeeper and you kick it out to a defender, he can't pass it immediately back to you. That we have been trying out new rules in recent years, that I just find it extraordinary that there is a significant rule that exists separate to the Standing Rules Committee, who need to work tooth and nail to actually get them some league trial time, and then it gets ditched for the championship, whereas this is just brought in and straight into the championship this year.
Well, it's amazing, really, because it's quite a significant rule. You know, it is quite a significant. Now, you know, the powers that be will say, well, you know, we should have known it was there. Like, I mean, you know, I think there is notification that's put out. Now, if you actually have time to sit down and read through it and actually see what exactly is on the floor. But it was obviously out there. It is quite amazing that it just gets through that quickly. Again, it's another alteration to an already altered game. Like, I mean, Gaelic football has been altered so much in the last 12 months. It's unbelievable. It's you know, between the mark, between different stuff. Now they just throw another thing in there. And it is, as you say, it just gets kind of kicked on, passed through. And a lot of times, as I say, these things get, if you can get the president and say the Uachtaráin, if you can get the director general, and if you can get a lot of the top table either bringing a motion forward or proposing it,
it will pass.
It's done. It absolutely sails through. And yeah. It can be as controversial as you like, but it will sail through.
It's interesting. So when we look at that, and of course the big talking point of Congress is actually a hurling talking point around the black card. Trashed, 82% against it, not getting in. It's interesting, John Horan was talking about that. And he says, personally, I wouldn't be satisfied with the way it was pushed back by high-profile characters coming out. And whereas they've never fully denied that cynicism is there in hurling, and we know that, see some of the tackles, but yeah, they railed against it. Unfortunately, we can only chair the meeting. I would concur with those concerns. So you compare the national talk about black cards and apparently the fact that hurling was given UNESCO heritage status a couple of years ago was mentioned multiple times in arguments on Friday night. The fact that this was like a big public thing was always going to be a contributing factor to this getting hammered and not passing. Whereas, as we mentioned with Tommy earlier on, for people just joining us, 9:34, according to Maliki Clerkin's piece here on Friday night, the motion was proposed for the back pass. At 9:36,
it was passed. Mm. So you're talking about weeks and weeks and weeks of widespread debate, and you know that's obviously not the GAA's fault or anything, of widespread debate, hurling, men standing up for hurling over the last few weeks, and here we go, 2 minutes to a rule change in how the game is literally going to be played. And like, it's the headline of Malachy's piece is, again, Congress shows that no one sticks up for football. Is that true?
Well, you would certainly think about it. You know, if you thought about all of the different changes that have happened to Gaelic football over the last, as I say, 12, 24, you know, months, you would have to think there is no one really kind of saying. Like, the hurling thing really amazed me, because there were a lot of high-profile hurling people coming out and saying, no. But they're giving their opinion.
Yeah.
But that should not affect the opinion then of the top table and the people who are ultimately the clubs and everyone else who's actually going to say, no, we need to vote for this or we don't need to vote for this. And like, that's fine. You know, no one had a chance to talk about this one. You know, I don't know. Maybe it just got lost in the ether with all of the talk about the black card, but very, very few.
This is a Trojan horse.
Exactly. And by the way, there's nearly always a Trojan horse every year at Congress. There's nearly always something that's slipped in. As I said, there's a place you put these things, you know, where you're going to get minimal or maximum kind of coverage. And if you want minimum coverage, minimum fuss, you stick it in late on a Friday evening when everyone's going home. Everyone has already been there since probably 5 or 6 o'clock. They're tired. They're after listening to 3.5, 4 hours of this stuff. They're saying to themselves, I'm out of here. I have to come here again tomorrow morning. A lot of them used to stay over. So you can imagine things are kind of woolly on a Saturday morning after the big breakfast. So if you want to get her in on the Saturday morning, that's a good time to do it as well. So it's either Friday evening, Saturday morning. Don't do it don't do it at 6:30, 7 o'clock on a Friday evening. That's where the real stuff is debated. People are all full of energy and ready to go. So look, I'm amazed. I tell you, I've done one and I'll never do it again. It was 3 hours of my life. I'll never get back.
I feel like we should actually send you on behalf of Off the Ball next year for a running commentary. Just on a practical level then, like, we started to see the sweeper-keeper become more of a thing recently, or the roving keeper. Does this now diminish this summer that Roy Beggam won't be kind of popping out to the wing to receive the pass back because he literally can't get it anymore? Or is it actually just one little facet he can still come out once it's the second pass back?
Yeah, I think it's one little facet. I think what you'd have to do is you just make a way around it. So what you do is I kick to you. You have to have a player close to you. In other words, someone to come and take the ball off you. Say a hand pass. So someone comes looping around your shoulder, you hand pass, and then he kicks back to the goalkeeper, and away you go. You know, it's just an added pass. That's really all it is. You know, it's like, I mean, I like the fact that goalkeepers are coming into the game more.
Well, it's been innovation. Like, I think we should be applauding innovation.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, it's funny, I saw Shane Curran tweeting over the weekend. Like, Shane used to come out of goal all the time. Like, I mean, he was absolutely...
Well, he wouldn't need a pass back. He would just solo.
He was like, he'd actually give you the ball and roar the man. He'd give it to you in trouble nearly, so you're about to get absolutely killed, so you'd have to give it back to him. And then he'd take off. And, of course, he'd be abusing lads and he'd be talking to them on the way back. I remember we played them in a challenge match. I was like, this lad is absolutely crazy because he was just coming out. He was standing around the 45. Now, obviously, you see the downside of it with the Donegal Monaghan game at the weekend, where Beggan got caught with an unbelievable kick out by Pat.
What a kick out against the wind as well.
Oh, phenomenal. I know the wind died down at halftime, but it didn't turn, you know.
Yeah.
But like, he literally kicked it like he had the breeze behind him. He has, like, he's not a big guy, you know. You compare him to Durkin, who was there a couple of years back. And even last year, now he's put on a bit of bulk and his legs have looked like he got a bit stronger, but he's not a fella who you'd look at and go, he can kick the ball 70
yards. Yeah, like Beggan is a beast and you can...
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and Morgan is a big enough guy. Yeah. Whereas Patton, you know, even last year, now, as I say, he's built up a bit, but he has a strike that is just so sweet. Mm. And it was brilliant because if you watch it, it's hard to really see in the TV, but he's looking out to his left as if he's going to go short. And then he kind of looks to his right. And then at the last second, he just runs and bang, straight down the middle. And it was really, really well done. I was very impressed with Donegal. I thought McBurty was phenomenal. Mm. He's back, and he's back stronger, and he's back quicker. You know, a lot of guys come back from those injuries and they lose a yard. There was a great little cameo where he just ducked inside one of the Monaghan defenders and just took off. Monaghan are, you know, I remember someone talking about one-trick ponies. Monaghan are a very one-trick team. They showed it against Dublin. They have this all-out counter-attacking, we spoke about it, where the cornerbacks, the fullback, everyone goes to try to go beyond the kind of blanket, get in behind you. And but it is a very, very high-energy, high-octane game. And when you're up in Donegal on a bog of a pitch, coming against a blanket that is Donegal, and you've only got McManus up front, it is wickedly tough. McGee giving McManus plenty of it, you know, just in his ear, hitting him every time the ball came near him, defending him really well from out in front. They really struggled, Monaghan, and it was no surprise that once Donegal got the goal and kind of started to sneak ahead, then of course, you know, the cards happened, and that was Monaghan's goose cooked. But it's a worry for Monaghan in the sense of, I still don't see a lot of talk about McCarthy coming into this game. He was really played out of it, you know, he got a lot of attention. I think he got one score. But the whole forward line, you're again looking going, who's going to really get the scores for them if they come up against a similar type of system again? Mm. If you play running game against them and have it very open, yeah, they're going to get plenty of scores. But I think if you just retreat and go, OK, try and run through us, we're going to do what you want to do to us, to you.
Yeah.
And Donegal are the masters at that.
And then a final point, Mayo looking in big trouble at this point.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, I spoke to you about the Meade-Kerry game, and I expected Mayo to go up and beat the spread on this because I thought there would be a kick in them. Mm. And at halftime, I just went, oh, well, I got that completely wrong. And I was amazed to see by the end what they did. Now, watching it back, look, I mean, they just were absolutely terrible the first half.
Horrific.
Look, I mean, their lack of being on it. There was Kerry fellas just, you know, it was a hand going in, guy gone, then Mayo lads just standing up. There was no retreating, there was no chasing back, there was no sense of urgency at all. Mm. Which is a worry, because you would imagine Horan, like, the one thing you can't say about Meade is that they're not having a sense of urgency. Like, they ran themselves ragged yesterday. They fought and fought and fought, and they have been fighting the last few games, and the players are all putting their shoulder to the wheel. But Mayo were, like, I mean, if I was a Mayo fan at that halftime, I'd say these guys aren't playing for Horan. They're just not playing. There's nothing going on here. Now, second half, you kind of go, okay, yeah, they definitely put a shift in. Like, Aidan O'Shea put a massive shift in, and all of them did. They got it together, and they actually came back at Kerry. Now, Kerry probably really set their own because they just sat back and they kind of invited Mayo on a bit. But Kerry are, there's a few little worries going on there in Kerry, I'd say, too. You know, they haven't been shooting the lights out at all. No. And then, you know, Cork, unbeknownst to anyone, are just rattling through that division. Now, you would expect them to rattle through the division, but they're dismissing teams very, very easily, you know, and playing decent football. And I'm not saying
it's a Munster semi-final as well this year. You get Kerry earlier on, so.
They'll come in under the radar. Cork will come in under the radar, you know.
Listen, Anthony Moyles, thanks many for popping in this morning. More Congress chat next time you're in, hopefully. We are talking Liverpool's unbeaten Premier League run coming to an end next, because on OTB AM we've got James Pearce of The Athletic standing by. Back after these. OTB AM. Delighted to say The Athletic's James Pearce is with us now on the line. Good morning to you, James.
Good morning.
So 3-0 to Watford on Saturday night. I think the natural starting point here is, what happened to Liverpool?
It's a good question. Yeah, I think it was a throwback, really, wasn't it, to the kind of performance that, you know, it's been a long, long time since Liverpool fans have witnessed anything quite like that. I think, you know, you have to go back to October 2017, the 4-1 defeat to Tottenham at Wembley for the last time they lost a Premier League game by more than one goal. I think it was just a disastrous performance from start to finish. I think, I don't think it's fair to scapegoat any one individual or pinpoint any one particular area. I think it was just a massively disappointing performance in all departments. You know, vulnerable defensively. You know, no spark or creativity in midfield, and toothless up front. And Watford thoroughly deserved to be the team that ended Liverpool's 44 game unbeaten run.
I always thought it was going to be something bizarre that might end this unbeaten run. I really didn't expect it to be a comprehensive victory for any one side. And I'm sure you probably share that same sense of surprise, and a lot of the Liverpool supporters do as well, that this is just so unbecoming of this current Liverpool side.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. I think even, you know, it was, you know, even watching that game at the weekend, you know, you get to half time and you think there have actually been quite a few games like that this season where Liverpool have started pretty slowly and you think, you know, Klopp will get them going second half. You know, they'll just raise it. We've seen it time and time again from this Liverpool team. you know, how resilient they are when they're not at their best. They dig in, they grind out results. And, you know, even at 1-0, even at 2-0, you know, I was sat there thinking, you know, they'll come alive. You know, they'll come to life here, and, you know, there's still something to be salvaged. But it just never happened. And, you know, I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think, you know, there's no question they massively missed Joe Gomez at the weekend. I mean, Dejan Lovren was a lightning rod for criticism, which I think, you know, it's unfair just to blame him. But there's no doubt that, you know, he made some poor decision making and, you know, poor errors in the game, which sparked a bit of panic around him. And I think also the last two matches have underlined how much, you know, the importance of Jordan Henderson to this team, because, you know, Liverpool without Gomez and without Henderson aren't the same force. And I think also in general, you know, when you actually look at Liverpool's performances since the winter break, you know, they have been disjointed, you know, and they found a way to win at Norwich. They found a way to beat.
Oh, we seem to have lost James Pearce on the line there, chatting about Watford 3, Liverpool 0 over the course of the weekend, chatting there about Liverpool's return from the winter break. And we will get Mark Lawrenson's take on Liverpool now as well. He was in conversation with Stephen Doyle.
It was a real kind of wheels falling off. I was working for LFC TV, and we had an interview with Klopp, and the impression was, in many ways, he was almost kind of like, thank goodness it's ended, because now we can just get on with winning the league, etc. I think he said, his comment was something like, oh yeah, maybe in 500 years people would have recognised it as a good record. But no, they just didn't play at all. I thought as well that Lovren looked extremely rusty. Troy Deeney basically had him on toast. In the end, Lovren's trying to fight him, which is exactly what Deeney wanted. And I think the performance of Lovren actually made Virgil van Dijk look ordinary yesterday. But they just didn't play. I mean, there's, you know, you can dress it up whichever way you want. They just weren't good enough on the day. And it's nothing about, you know, nerves or lack of effort or weary, whatever it is. They just did not play well. It happens, we know.
You didn't think it was a weariness? That was the one I felt most likely.
No. Well, they just had a break, haven't they? No, and the thing about all these football clubs now is that, you know, you can test the white blood cells and the red blood cells, and quite often a lot of them are tested the day before a game, and the doctor can actually say to the manager, oh, by the way, you know, Bobby Firmino's a little bit low. And the manager has to make a decision then, thinking, well, shall I leave him out or play him? So, no, I mean, the sports science is so, so good nowadays that they kind of know when people are in the red zone.
That's interesting. Mark Lawrenson speaking to Joe on yesterday's Off the Ball. James Pearce is back with us on the line. Do you subscribe to that, James, that perhaps the physical attributes aren't to blame here at all, that it may is just maybe just a mental thing, that, I don't know, they perhaps lacked a fight on Saturday night at times?
Yeah, I certainly don't think you can blame fatigue. I actually think, you know, the winter break has probably counted against Liverpool in terms of they've lost their rhythm. You know, the four performances since the winter break have been very disjointed. And yes, they found a way to win at Norwich. They sneaked over the line at home to West Ham, but they were very poor over in Madrid and very poor again at the weekend. So, I think there were a number of factors for the weekend. I think a bit of complacency probably crept in as well, because I think, you know, when you're on an incredible run like this, you know, you kind of almost feel as if it won't ever end. And, you know, maybe they forgot at the weekend that you have to earn that right every single time you step out onto the pitch, especially against a team like Watford who are fighting for their lives at the bottom.
How important a factor is this now in how we judge the legacy of this particular season for Liverpool? Of course, there are more trophies to be played for. Chelsea tomorrow night is a big game. The Atletico second leg is a huge game. But is this one little thread being taken out of this Liverpool side this season, being the second Invincibles of the Premier League era, which you would suspect more points, would have been a huge crowning glory for Liverpool's first Premier League title?
Yeah, I think, you know, I wrote after the weekend, I don't think the Watford defeat defines this season, but I think what will define this season is how they respond to it, because there's still so much to be achieved. I mean, I've never been, you know, massively subscribed to the, you know, the importance of emulating the Arsenal Invincibles. I just think, yeah, football is about winning trophies and about success. It's not about records. Of course, you know, that would have been nice, but, you know, I think winning the FA Cup or the Champions League, or preferably both of them, are much more important than than going unbeaten for an entire Premier League season. And there's still so much to be achieved. I think the big thing for Klopp is, you know, they are in a little mini slump at the moment, performance-wise. And he'll know that this is a huge week coming up. You know, Chelsea away in the FA Cup tomorrow night, which, you know, Chelsea, their form has been very inconsistent themselves. You know, that's a tie, even with 3, 4, 5, 6 changes. You know, Liverpool are more than capable of going there and winning. And then suddenly you're in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup. And then, you know, on the horizon next Wednesday night at Anfield, a huge European night against Atletico and trying to turn around that deficit. So, I think these next, the next kind of 8, 9 days, you know, are absolutely huge for Liverpool, because, you know, this team have been, you know, given so many plaudits this season, and rightly so, because, you know, their consistency has been awe-inspiring at times. But, you know, Liverpool are going to win the Premier League title regardless. But I just think, you know, if they were to go out of the FA Cup, go out of the Champions League and just limp over the line in the Premier League, I think it would leave a little bit of a sense of anticlimax, considering what this season, you know, threatened to produce. So the big job for Klopp, is at Melwood in the next coming days, is to trigger, you know, a big spirited response. And, you know, Liverpool actually had a similar drop in form around this time last season, and ended up, springing back into life and finishing the campaign very, very strongly. So, you know, hopefully lightning will strike twice.
Yeah, I completely agree with you that it would lead to a bit of an anticlimactic end to the season if that were to happen, if they were to crash out of both of those cup competitions in the next week and a half or thereabouts. Like, just on that, I wonder if the whole narrative around comparing Liverpool to other teams is part of that too. That's like, you would probably disagree with the point of comparing Liverpool to the Arsenal Invincibles, because it is about winning trophies. But if you look closer to home and you look towards Manchester and you look towards the many, many comparisons, especially on Sky Sports, between this Liverpool team and the treble winning team, that sort of crystallises the stakes now in front of Liverpool in terms of going down in the Hall of Fame of great English teams that we've seen, that there is this comparison. Winning multiple trophies is something that this team needs to be targeting.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, there's been an aura around this team, hasn't there, this season in terms of what they've achieved and all the records that have fallen, you know, by the wayside. But, you know, this is now absolutely crunch time, because, yeah, if they want to be regarded as one of the all-time great teams who have ever graced English football, then, you know, you have to respond positively to setbacks. And, you know, I think back to the back end of last season and the crushing disappointment of missing out on the league title to Manchester City. You know, what happened? Liverpool came out swinging, they won the Champions League, and then embarked on this amazing, you know, procession to their first league title for 30 years. So, you know, that's the task for these players and this manager now. Can they respond in the same way? Because, you know, do you know what? If Liverpool go on and add the FA Cup or the Champions League, or preferably both, to the league title, then come the end of May, nobody's going to be banging on about a miserable day at Watford.
No, absolutely not. That will make it an absolutely sensational season, and it is already going to be a good year for them. Just a final point then, like, just one last thing that Mark Lawrenson said there about Dejan Lovren getting bullied by Troy Deeney. There is a slight comparison we can make here between that Atletico night and this Watford result, isn't there? That there is kind of like a hard edge to the teams that are beating Liverpool, that to beat Liverpool you need to try and bully them.
Yeah, I think to a certain degree. I think certainly, I think where the comparisons were is that, you know, Atletico and Watford both, you know, got in Liverpool's faces, didn't they? They didn't let Liverpool settle into their stride. They didn't let them establish a foothold in the game. I think of course Atletico are in a different class to Watford, I think. But you know, what I would say is that, you know, Liverpool have proved adept this season at breaking down teams that try and make life difficult for them. It was just in those two performances there was no spark, you know, there was no real guile, no creativity. I mean, how many, you know, you look at the stats afterwards and Salah, Mane, Firmino didn't have a single shot on target between them. You know, I can't remember that ever happening in a game before. So, you know, the big strength of this Liverpool team has been able to win games in so many different ways and hurt opposing teams in so many different ways, so that, you know, even when their teams are defending deep against them, you know, you've got the fullbacks, you know, marauding down the flanks and whipping in quality deliveries. You know, you've got runners from midfield getting up in support of the front three, and you've got, you know, that front line capable of producing a bit of inspiration. But, you know, for whatever reason, that just hasn't been there in those defeats away to Atletico and away to Watford. And, you know, getting that back is going to be absolutely crucial. And it's going to be intriguing to see how Klopp does treat the FA Cup game at Chelsea on Tuesday night, because, does what happened at the weekend just change things for him a little bit in terms of the number of changes that he will actually make? Because, I think, you know, a strong case could be made that Chelsea away in the FA Cup is actually probably a bigger game than Bournemouth at home in the league this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it probably is. Listen, it's going to be a fascinating end to the season. We'll chat to you again soon. James Pearce, thanks for taking the call.
Cheers.
James Pearce there on the line of theathletic.com. You can subscribe to check out more of his work. Tom Malone is with us in studio. How are you, Tom?
Good, and you?
What's the crack?
Yeah, loads of it. Loads of it. Busy all morning.
I'd imagine. So what is happening?
We're going to start with the League Cup. Manchester City are the English League Cup champions for the third year in a row. The holders beat Aston Villa by 2-1 at Wembley yesterday. Goals in that first half from Sergio Aguero and Rodri. But one person who wasn't too happy with it was Jack Grealish, because apparently the corner that led to the Rodri equaliser was not a corner, shouldn't have been given. And Grealish said after the match he wasn't too happy with some of those refereeing decisions.
It's obviously gutting, you know, like a club like Aston Villa, and you know, I haven't won anything for quite a long time now, and, you know, we come here today for a final and you know, we lose by a goal that should never have stood.
Meanwhile, Wolves are sixth in the Premier League this morning. That's after they came from behind twice to beat Spurs by 3-2 at the new White Hart Lane. Republic of Ireland's Matt Doherty scored and provided an assist in the win, and Dublin youngster Troy Parrott also was used by Jose Mourinho is a late, very, very late sub, but I suppose
token sub.
Jose can say, well, I brought him on, what's wrong with you? What's the problem? I brought him on, didn't score, just because it's the 92nd minute. Anyway, elsewhere it finished up 1-1 between Manchester United and Everton at Goodison Park. Dominic Calvert-Lewin thought, though, he'd gotten a late injury time winner for the hosts, but it was ruled out by VAR. And Carlo Ancelotti was unhappy with the decision, voiced his opinion on the refereeing while picking up a red card for his protests.
The end of the game was really impressive, really exciting, a lot of decision, a lot of important decision, but I didn't miss respect, and can happen, but we will see if I am banned or not.
Meanwhile, Celtic continued their defence of the Scottish Cup with a 1-0 win at St Johnstone yesterday. Ryan Christie's goal in the 81st minute was enough to see the holders through with a semi-final tie against Aberdeen up next. While in Gaelic games, Mayo are facing into a relegation battle to stay in Division 1 of the Allianz National Football League. They lost by a point to Kerry at McHale Park in Castlebar yesterday, where it finished 114-113. They now need 3 points from the remaining two games against Galway and Tyrone, as well as other results going their way. And manager James Horan says they were simply not good enough on the day.
The first half was poor from our side. We stood off too much, and we let Kerry play, and were second fiddle in a lot of things, breaking ball and kickouts and all that kind of stuff. Some areas that we're usually pretty strong on, so that was disappointing. And just our return on shots taken was poor in the first half. So we didn't take the chances when they did arise. So we let Kerry get into a very, very strong position.
Elsewhere, Donegal beat Monaghan by 2-12 to 8 points in Ballyshannon. Caelan Ward and Hugh McFadden both found the back of the net for the hosts. While in Navan, Meath were relegated after Galway beat the Royals 114-112 at Park Tolchin. While in Division 1 of Group B of the Hurling League, Clare beat Dublin by 27 points to 115 in Cusick Park. Eddie Brennan couldn't get the better of his former boss Brian Cody, as his Leash side were beaten 322-119 by Kilkenny. Wexford beat Carlow 229-111. And in Group A, Limerick made it 4 in a row when they saw off Westmeath 124-18 points at the Gaelic grounds. Galway beat Cork by 218-116, and Tipp beat Waterford 24 points to 216 in Thurles. While Waterford finished that game with just 13 men when Austin Gleeson and Kevin Moran were both shown straight red cards for striking, and then Tipp's Cathal Barrett was shown his marching orders for retaliation. And some breaking news as well in rugby. Chris Ashton and Sale Sharks are to part company. A brief statement from the club read that Sale Sharks released a statement moments ago saying Ashton will leave the club with immediate effect, having reached a mutual agreement. Ashton only signed for Sale Sharks in Toulon in 2018. The team currently sits second in the Premiership in the UK. And finally, in the NBA, it was a case of master and the rookie last night, as LeBron James' LA Lakers got the better of the Zion Williamson-inspired Pelicans 122-114 to get back to winning ways and top the Western Conference. And LeBron himself to a 34-point triple-double, but Zion outscored him with 34.
Not bad, 35. Not bad. Tom, we haven't actually given you enough credit on the show for the swimmer that you are. For anybody who doesn't know, we're doing the swim for a mile. We're going to attempt to do the swim for a mile, and Tom is the star pupil. I must actually ask you, since you are the star pupil, what often happens in when you are the best in the class, you were just left to your own devices. You were so good that we've actually been coached to actually survive and not die in the swimming pool. Do you feel that we're closing the gap on you?
I know, absolutely. Like, Jer and Nate, well, you have gone unbelievably well.
Thank you.
Like, I think Shane Hannan kind of thought that you had never actually swum before.
And Stephen Doyle as well.
Okay. So, no, but like, you know, you did over a length the last day. Yeah.
Yeah, just 62 at all city, Tom. Thanks for that.
Yeah, but it's like, it's so insanely difficult. Like, the coach is amazing, in fairness. I've improved massively as well. So, the pack are catching up. But I think a lot of the credit must go to Pete, the coach.
Someone completed a mile yesterday. I'm not going to reveal who.
Okay.
So have you swam the mile yet? Somebody's already swam the mile before.
I've never swam a mile before.
Right. Okay.
So I fancy myself to beat anyone in a race, a short term race. I'd absolutely back myself.
Well, just give me a couple of more weeks, Tom.
Couple weeks would be easy. Yeah. No, I've never swum a mile before, so that's why I signed up for the challenge.
Well, there you go. I signed up for the challenge so that if I ever get caught in water, I won't die.
That's the best thing about swimming, because you know there are so many benefits to swimming. The best part, it can save your life.
Absolutely. So we'll be out training this afternoon. More videos to come over the next few weeks. Just to inform you as well, if you want to do it, I would wholly encourage it. You have to be of no standard whatsoever to do it. It is Swim Ireland's Swim for a Mile Challenge. Head on to swimforamile.com for more information on participating pools and their training information. You can sign up for a free account today to access the downloadable training program and book your Swim for a Mile event. Tom, thanks a million for popping in this morning. That's Nearly Us this morning on OTBAM. We're giving the final word on this Monday to Mark Lawrenson, because he joined Stephen Doyle on commentary yesterday afternoon for Everton 1, Manchester United 1. And afterwards, he gave us his takes on the sides stuttering towards fourth place in the Premier League and, of course, Liverpool's unbeaten run coming to an end. Chat to you tomorrow morning at 7:30. Good luck.
Now, it's a pleasure to be with Mark Lawrenson at Goodison Park today. 1-1 draw.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, we thought it was going to be a cracker of a game in the first 20 minutes, didn't we?
Yeah, I think it was so good. Eventually, I think they tied themselves out, both teams. I thought United were really impressive in the first half, but obviously Everton stuck at it. I think the early goal and mistake by De Gea obviously helped them. But United at times today showed a little bit of quality that I've not seen probably from them for most of the season.
When you think back to the start of this season, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was getting an awful lot of criticism, I suppose rightly so. The team were playing badly. Mm-hmm. Slowly but surely, he started to move players out of the club and bring some new players in. You know, he deserves a lot of credit now, you'd have to say, after the last number of weeks, considering the amount of criticism he got when things were going wrong.
Yeah, you feel like it looks like they've started to turn the corner. I'm a little bit kind of not 100% sure, because we've seen this a little bit for false dawns from them before, and then all of a sudden they go and lose away to Watford or get beat at home by somebody. But I think the signing of Fernandes has made them look completely different. And in a dressing room, when you see a player who comes in who's got obvious ability, you know, straight away all the forward players are thinking, wow, this fella can see a pass, and this fella might play me in, and this fella might make me a better player. And by the way, he's also nicked a couple of goals since he's been here. And I think, you know, Matic is back, which is good. McTominay's back, so they've got that little barrier in terms of central midfield. Maguire's been outstanding. The right back looks a good player. Generally, the goalkeeper's outstanding. You know, I know Rashford is out, but they're starting now to look like a good team. I think they've got a good a chance as anybody in finishing Champions League.
You mentioned a couple of times during the commentary about their passing, how impressed you were. It's very sharp, very quick. They're trying to get the ball forward as much as possible. Is that down to the new players coming in, or is it down to a lot of coaching by Solskjaer off the field?
I think it's down to Fernandes as much as anything, because they've had, is it Pereira in there? Mata are in there as well. And Fred, when we've watched Fred, and Fred started today and did okay, when we watched Fred before, he kind of looked like a little boy lost. But again, now it looks like he's come alive. No, I think, you know, sometimes you just have one player and it kind of sparks the whole thing. They've got loads of pace. They've got players missing today, James. Rashford, obviously, is also a big miss. But all of a sudden, in midfield, they look like they can construct passes. They're all quick. You know, they've all got a good touch as well. And if they need to scrap, they've got, you know, the same McTominay and Matic. And then you've got, obviously, Lindelof and Maguire, etc. So all the parts of the components of the team are starting to look better.
Yeah, you mentioned Lindelof, Maguire. You know, we have to give credit to their back four. Like, I know he's played with the back three as well a couple of times over the last number of weeks. But
yeah, I don't think he'll do that again.
Yeah,
I think now when he looks at the makeup of his team, he doesn't need to, because he's got that barrier in front of the two central defenders. So I would think his use of a back, I think that'll go now. That'll disappear.
Is Ancelotti in a kind of a similar situation to maybe what Solskjaer was in when he took over at Old Trafford? Because Everton went on a spending spree over the last four or five seasons.
Yeah, every player they bought was 50 million.
Yeah, I think every
player was 50 million.
I think
amazing.
They've nearly spent over 400 million pounds now since Mashiri came in and took over the ownership of the club. Farhad Mashiri, I should say. So is Ancelotti kind of in a similar situation to Solskjaer, where he's got all these different bits and parts and no players that he's brought in himself, and he's just really trying to get to the end of the season when he can start maybe putting his own imprint on his team and buying his own players?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, I wasn't quite sure, but he said in January he wasn't going to buy any players, and I kind of thought, phew, you look like you need one or two, but he's obviously, they've all bought into him. We know he's a very, very good manager, and he's playing 4-4-2. Is one of the very few teams that plays 4-4-2. Calvert-Lewin's starting to look like a really good player, and he's added goals to his game. We know Richarlison's also a good player. I think with a little bit of him in midfield, he's maybe got one or two players who are very samey. So he might do something and address that. He doesn't need that many players, in all honesty. And the thing is as well, at this place, you know, when it gets rocking, it's a really difficult place to come and play. So if he gets the right players, Everton will be a force. And we know they want to move to the new stadium, which is only 2 or 3 miles away, etc. And hopefully for Everton that will happen. But if he's in charge, you'd have to. If he's in charge for the next 2 or 3 years, you think it would definitely happen.
He did say in January that he wants to hold on to Richarlison. Now, you always kind of get the feeling with Richarlison, is he one of those players that is going to get his head down and, you know, give all he can for this club, or is he always maybe looking for the next move? How important do you think he is to Everton? Do you think it's important to keep him here?
Yeah.
Or maybe to offload him and get the big transfer fee?
No, I think you keep him. I think you keep your best players. And I get the impression, watching him play today, he was chasing back and everything. So I think the manager knows how to press his buttons, as it were. And the other thing with Richarlison, that thing about going to Barcelona, I didn't think that was just paper talk. But the thing with him, if you start to get better players in to help him and to give him more service, which I think they will do, he'll then start to score even more goals and become a really... I mean, he's a good player now, but I think he can become a top player. And he's still relatively young as well. So I would hope he hasn't had his head turned by, you know, somebody trying to tap him up saying, come and play for Barcelona or Madrid. He isn't at that level yet.
Jordan Pickford's another blunder from him today. And again, we spoke, Mark, during the game about Gareth Southgate being here. He was at St James's Park yesterday. Mm-hmm. Look, Gareth Southgate could be looking at any number of players in these games. Yeah. But there is a possibility that Nick Pope, who's been in brilliant form for Burnley this season, could really put Jordan Pickford under pressure for England in the European Championships this year.
There is. I still think Pickford's number one. Yes, he made a mistake today, but then he made a really good double save. In fact, the second of the double save, as it were, I thought was outstanding, again with his feet, but that doesn't really matter. But I think it's one of them, you know, when you really look at it, Pope plays in front of a back four at Burnley who are unbelievably well drilled. They head it and they kick it and they do it all day long. And he really, you know, he doesn't... Pope's not a guy who kind of come for crosses or anything. He's a really good shot stopper. So he's had a really good season. But I do feel, I mean, you know, the England manager's probably just left by now, and he's still thinking, look, Pickford's my number one. And I think it's like anything, but I just think with Pickford, sometimes he's a little bit immature in terms of not just on the pitch, but off the pitch. And he just needs to keep his head down, because he's a very, very good goalkeeper. And I think he's probably the best English one there is. He just made a few mistakes. But it's like anything, especially over here. If you make a mistake, you get absolutely slaughtered. But the fact he can recover and make a double save towards the end, I still think he'll be England's number one.
Now, from an Irish perspective, really sad to see Seamus Coleman going off injured today. Look, we'll hope it's not a really serious injury that will keep him out of the big playoff this month against Slovakia. But if he was to miss out, it would be a big blow. But as we saw again today, Matt Doherty scoring for Wolverhampton Wanderers against Tottenham Hotspur. Disappointment for Mick because he needs strength and depth, doesn't he, going into a tie like this?
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, in a nutshell, you know, when he's got everyone fit, Mick, we're very, very competitive. And we're very, very competitive, but we ain't really got any goals in us, which is, you know, which is the greatest problem because it is the hardest problem to solve, get somebody scoring your goals. But we'd want as many people fit as possible. And then, you know, if you want to change a little bit, you've got that opportunity. I just feel with our team, it almost kind of picks itself at the moment. But, you know, a few days before we play the first big game, that Mick will just be, he'll have his phone on thinking, I hope it doesn't ring, because it won't be good news, it'll be bad news. So we could do without any more bad news, and hopefully Seamus is fit.
Yeah, Mick seems to be reluctant, though, to play Matt Doherty from the start of games if Seamus Coleman is fit. And as you said, we need goals. If you've got a player like Matt Doherty scoring goals, then surely you have to try and squeeze him into the team somewhere.
Well, do you, for one player, alter the system? That's the question. And Mick's not like that. Mick's, as you know, I played with him for a long, long time, and I think he's a very good manager, a very good manager. Mick's not for bending. And he can suggest all the things you want to him, but he's got a way of playing. And as a manager, he's done a very, very good job wherever he's gone. So I don't see that. I don't see him changing the team. He might just say to Doherty, say, look, you know, come on, play right back, but maybe you can't bomb on all the time. Kind of pick your moment. So, hey, we'll wait and see.
Troy Parrott then as well coming on today for Tottenham Hotspur. As you spoke to Joe on the radio about it, coming on the 90th minute, he's not going to do too much from there. Look, Mark, from your own experience, if he's in this situation in the summer where he's at the club, he's after signing a new contract, and if Mourinho's going to be still there and he's starting to get frustrated, he's not getting games, should he just be looking to go out alone in the summer?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, it's like a, you know, we study here at Goodison, but across the road at Liverpool, they've let one or two of them out, and they've let them out for a few years. Because the other thing with the club, it's a two-way street, because some of the players, look at Harry Wilson, who's at Bournemouth, he's not going to get in Liverpool's first team. He did well at Derby, he's done really well at Bournemouth. And, you know, if they sell him for 20 million, it's paid for the academy. And also, until you let players out, you know, you don't. Where do they play? That's the other thing. So they play in the under-23s. Well, that doesn't really mean a lot. They need to be playing. The Championship's brilliant. You know, I'm a massive Preston fan. I watch loads of Preston, and there's loads. You see loads of lone players. That's the only way you can see that they improve. And by the way, when they leave and go back to the parent club, they suddenly realise how big the parent club is, how good a club it is. But listen, it's for the football club, it's a way of making money, and it's a way of looking at those players and judging them and saying, like, Liverpool want Champions League players. Do I think Harry Wilson will play in the Champions League for Liverpool? I very much doubt it. But he might go and sign for a Burnley or whatever to 20, 25 million. And it's a two-way street, but they have to play because they have to prove themselves. And they want... It's no good playing... They play these little games, organised games against other sides where they're just friendlies and it's like 3:30 minutes, but nobody tackles. It's not competitive. It's just all about your fitness. So, no, go in the Championship.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station. That was an Off The Ball Podcast Network presentation.